Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for tuning in to the Vigilance Press podcast. My name is James Dossey, and I am the publisher and host tonight for Vigilance Press. Tonight I have a very special guest, our very frequent favorite guest, Jack Norris.
Ooh, hello.
Hey, Jack, how you doing today?
Doing all right.
What's the weather like up there?
It's kind of cold but clear. It feels more like fall than spring, but it ain't so bad.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been yo-yoing back down to, you know, I keep thinking that I can pack my jacket away for the summer, and then I have to pull it back down again.
I've had the same thing, so
But all right, so just to give people a little heads up, we have been off the air for a little over a month now, and mainly that's been because I've just been so busy. My original intention was to really get some stuff done, to some podcasts recorded, and have like one a week this past month, but I got hit with a bunch of new projects that we've been for both Vigilance and elsewhere. I can't really talk about just yet, but that and we've had some medical issues behind the scenes that have made life more complicated for certain people just trying to get things done. But fortunately, all of those have been resolved, and we are back and firing on all cylinders again. For people who might be wondering what's going on with our publishing schedule, there has been some developments. Basically, once we got the Octoberman print edition done, and that was kind of a project where we kept back revisiting the same content several times as we updated. Once we published the Octoberman first last year in October, and we published it for Mutants and Masterminds. Jack Norris, obviously, is the author of the Octoberman, so yep. Fortunate that he's here to back me up on this if I make any mistakes. But we then wanted to, you know, offer it as a print on demand, and since taking over Vigilance, I've learned that, you know, this is basically going to be our first print on demand product. And going through the ropes of getting something done in print on demand was kind of interesting and a very educational process for all of us involved. And now that we've got the print on demand version of the Octoberman out there, and we had to actually expand the content, add new content to reach a certain page count in order to make that happen. But now that we've actually got that going, we decided that rather than kind of revisiting projects after we've published them, it makes a lot more sense just to get it right the first time.
Yeah, I mean, I think James will back me up on this, that it's a lot easier when you're in the development process to just add, you know, it's rare that you can't add something to a product, an idea, you know, to give a little something extra to the consumer than to reach a page count for printing. I mean, it's just not that big of a deal. It's like, oh, well, we could give a few extra characters. We could talk about this part we only sort of briefly talked about more, or we could expand this a little bit more. We could give a little more history, or, you know, we could talk about the comics that like inspired this or whatever. And, you know, doing that up front with your initial outlines and your initial product is way easier than trying to add it later. And yeah. I think then what that, you know, basically what that means is that going forward, at least everything James has talked to me about, with the exception of the intentionally smaller products like Devilish Duos and such, they're going to pretty much all be available on print on demand. Is that pretty much the plan?
That is the goal going forward, is to have all of our products release, you know, day and date, you know, the PDF and the print on demand same day. And what that means is that I'll be getting a lot more proofs in the mail over the next coming weeks. Actually, currently in layout is the Field Guide to Superheroes for Icons, Volume 4, which is actually the fourth and final volume of the Icon series by Jason Tondreau, also known as Dr. Comics. And once that's done, it'll also be the first of the chapters to actually be available in print-on-demand format. We may go back over the course of the year and revisit the first three volumes for print-on-demand. We are sort of looking at the demand for that right now and trying to gauge that. But once we get this one done, we are also considering doing a Mutants and Masterminds edition of the field guide as one massive omnibus. And Jason and I have already had some conversations about that and are looking at doing that. So if you're interested, please email us. You can reach me at james@jamesdawsey.com. That's JamesDawsey. You can just email me and just put in there letter to the editor as the subject heading. Any emails you send in, I will possibly publish in some of our products, though. So keep that also, in mind. Keep your language clean.
Cool. Yes. I'll throw this out too for folks who are Icons fans, because it may be just a piece of information you may not have found elsewhere, but I actually recently found out from Gareth Michael Skarka, the head of Adamant, who publishes Icons, that their products, the Team Up and all those guides, are coming out. You know, they're still. I think that one of the adventures may have gotten one of the adventures publications may have gotten canceled, but most of the other stuff is still planning on coming out. Their big change is that due to costs of distribution, they're mostly going to be direct shipping and direct distributing for the print versions from now on. So, folks who are looking to find Icons in your local game store, you might have a little better luck. Maybe not the initial books and such, but for stuff going forward, you might have a little better luck checking out the website or contacting them. So, if you're not seeing something in your friendly local game store, it isn't necessarily because it's not out. It's because I guess the percentage cut on distribution for Adamant has been high enough that they're considering shipping to folks directly, mailing them the books or otherwise. So I don't really know. I mean, that's more his Gareth than Adamant's thing, but I just happened to note it. And since it involves Icons and folks that are listening to this might be going, hey, does anybody know anything about Team Up or any of the other stuff coming out? It's like, I don't have a lot of information, but I will say that you're probably going to see those coming out, maybe I don't think print on demand. I think they are getting print runs, but mm-hmm. being distributed from them and or through, actually, I think through Cubicle 7, who does their distribution, which is actually good news because Cubicle 7 distributes a lot of stuff, and they have a pretty wide distribution net. And from what I understand, they're pretty good about it. So, mm-hmm. The guys who did the Doctor Who game, and they also put out the Lord of the Rings game and such. And so they have a pretty wide wide reach, but I think for the time being, I think it's going to be coming out more in a direct sales method than just throwing a bunch of copies at game stores and seeing what sells.
And if you guys want to comment directly on the podcast blog here, if you I don't know how many people actually tune in via iTunes and how many people go to the website, but if you go to the website vigilancepress.com. That will redirect you directly to our Podbean blog, and you can actually comment right on the show, and you can give feedback, ask questions. And if you guys are interested in having, like, I can try and get Gareth back on the show to answer some of those questions about distribution.
Also, can you talk about Far West, because it sounds awesome.
Yeah, Far West does sound awesome. I tried to get him to talk about that last time, but he was more interested in talking about the Icon stuff. So
I can understand that. But Far West it sounds awesome, though.
I think it's still a little early days for the Far West stuff to talk it into the ground.
I understand the early days of production something and not wanting to talk about
it. Speaking of early days, just to let you guys know what is coming out very soon from Vigilance, that's us. We actually, we got such a good feedback on the October Men and the sequel to the October Men is ramping up and looking really good. The artwork, I had a lot of help from my friend Denise Jones, who also did our cover for the upcoming Arthur Lives Kickstarter, which we'll be talking about in a couple of weeks here.
She also did the cover for Strange Attractors, which was
And Strange Attractors by Jack. Which is also one of the fastest selling things we've had since I took over Vigilance Press.
Thank you.
Thank everybody. Thank everybody who participated in that one, because that was one of those things where we kind of did it on an impulse and it was surprisingly popular. So I'm really happy to see
it was a weird combination of impulse and a cool idea and some people talking about things on the Atomic Think Tank or the Mutant Masterminds forums and saying, we'd like this. And I'm like, well, people would really like that. I think I could do it. And so So that, for folks who don't know, that's our romance rules, romance comic sort of supplement that includes, in addition to a couple characters and sort of romantic comedy sort of story seeds and such, and a history of sort of romance and comics, both in superhero comics and romance comics themselves. It also includes like a fairly light, driven by role playing system that is that uses the Mutants and Masterminds rules to do romance. So, you know, if you want to say, well, hey, you know, I go out on a date with this girl, what happens? And, you know, does this person like me? Does this person not like me? You know, when's a good time to pick up a romance complication, et cetera, et cetera. It seems to be pretty well received. One of the best compliments I've gotten from the reviewers are the guys who say that they don't normally use systems for that, and who actually said that they're going to use it. So that was always good.
Yeah.
Who were like, you know, I don't ever use this. I can just role play it all out and have it be like, I'm totally going to use this. That's always good to hear.
Yep. So I did have one question from one of our readers from Facebook. This is actually about the October Men, and then we can stop talking about it, because I've said the October Men about 50 times now, and unfortunately I'm not getting paid each time I say it. I wish I was, but but Joe Bardalis on Facebook asks, Jack, what was your inspiration for the October Men?
Okay, and actually, I can answer. This is one I can actually answer pretty easily, which is rare. My biggest. I love the old horror comics from the 70s. I love them. I do. When Roy Thomas and Marv Wolfman, all those guys, got together and started to push the boundaries of the comics code and see if they could bring horror back. I loved it. And one of the ways that they brought horror back was to bring it back in sort of the superhero comic worlds. So you got Tomb of Dracula, Werewolf by Night, Tales of the Zombie, I, Vampire over at DC. The Spectre took a very sort of horror turn. And they all happened in the comic universes, in the super universes. So Werewolf by Night would, you know, team up with Moon Knight first appeared in that comic. And he would then later appear to team up with Spider-Woman or, you know, Spider-Man or, Dracula fought the X-Men, that kind of stuff. And I always really loved that for, like, horror characters. I always thought that was a great, you know, a great sort of fun. It made them not just copies of the characters in the movies and books, but also gave them their own character, but also gave them sort of this dark corner of the comic universes that also had a really cool, like, superhero feel to it, too. You know, it wasn't just tacking on, like, you know, vampires from, like, take your favorite or least favorite vampire version and slap them in a game. One of the things that I also really liked about it was, about that period, was the things that grew out of it weren't just all things that affected the sort of horror area. Ghost Rider started up as a horror character. Tigra started up as Tigra as the Catwoman started up as a horror character. She originally was the cat, who was more of a female adventurer. But when she became Tigra, it was more of a horror title. It was more about monsters and such. And even Spider-Woman for a while there had a run of about 10, 15 issues in the middle of her 50-issue run where there was a lot of horror happening. And in some cases, there would even be, a story that Spider-Woman would only be nominally involved in. And I always love that stuff. I've always been, Tomb of Dracula particularly is one of my favorite comics growing up, and I still love it. And I love all that old stuff, and I love those characters with a sort of dark mystical bent. And, of course, to some lesser extent, Doctor Strange and such. And when coming up with an idea for a mystical bad guy, James and I kind of had the idea of like a mystical mercenary bad guy team. And I started thinking, well, what would you – let's put characters in that would kind of fit that niche. You know, that they're dark and they're scary and they're monsters, but they also are definitely fit into a superhero sort of feel, particularly that sort of superhero feel. That sort of, you know, a superhero but with some supernatural tinged around the edges. But at the same time, they could still fight Spider-Man or whatever, as long as there was a reason why Spider-Man would be fighting these mystical guys, mystical bad guys, he would fight them. And that was sort of my goal for Octoberman, is have people, and part of it was coming up with Springheel Jack as a character. And of course, my inspiration for him was the Legend of Springheel Jack, which if people want to look, he was a, supposed monster, folklorish figure from the 1900s. To take that character and decide, well, what does he want? And what would he want that would be sort of dark and magical, but there's something that any hero worth his salt would want to stop, regardless of whether or not he usually deals with mystical stuff. And that was sort of in creating those characters, I kind of had that realm of, you know, of sort of things of like, I wanted a group of nasty mystical characters who also had, you know, some sort of like, you didn't have to have a single mystic on your team to fight them, you know, and you know, you didn't have to feel like, oh man, we don't have any mages. I feel like we're, you know, in trouble. It's like, no, they're bad, you know, they're bad guys. And I also tried to hit in my own way is the, some fairly standard, but with the serial numbers seriously filed off, character types to kind of reinforce that. So you have your, you know, your big brawly frontline fighter guy, but he's a giant wolf, and you've got your sort of ninja, you know, freaky, you know, agile character, but she's like a corrupted nun who uses like blood magic, and you've got, you know, your wizard, you know, Green Lantern-y sort of, you know, can throw anything at you, but he's a floating skull, and et cetera. There's a few things I just threw in just because I thought they were fun, like L'Enfant Terrible, who I just threw in there because I just wanted to see how disturbing I could get without being too, like, far.
I thought he was in there just to try and push my buttons to see how far you could push me. No.
So many people think that.
No, it was the fun part. The fun part for me when I pitched it to Jack, it was basically, it was at Gen Con last year. It was basically the first day we bumped into each other. I said, hey, look, I'm trying to set up something where it'll be a series, and I really want to handle one of my favorite things to see in Super's role-playing games that I think are the most useful are the villain teams, where you have a team of villains that makes for a really good, you know, adventure in a bag. And that was the idea behind the whole Due Vigilance series of products. And, you know, the second one will be coming out soon, and we'll talk about that in relation to the Octobermen. But the pitch was basically, I want a group of characters who are mystical, because I don't think there weren't a lot of mystical characters out there for third edition Mutants and Masterminds at the time. And I really wanted to say, I want the mystical, but I want mercenaries, someone who can really kind of be brought into any storyline and be a real toolkit kind of team. And Jack goes, oh, I don't know, I'll think about it. And then he comes back the next day with the whole thing practically written.
It was practically written, but I at least had the characters. Well, what hit me for mercenary for that was, and this maybe kind of ties back to the question that sort of started the whole discussion about what was the inspiration. Mystical mercenary was something I was thinking about, and I was breaking those two words into, two separate words and thinking about them in that fashion. So I was thinking guys with mystical powers who are mercenaries, and I was thinking guys who fight for money. And it just wasn't clicking. It was not clicking with me. I was like, they got magic. They probably could have like an alchemist on their team and make gold. I don't understand why they'd want money. And then I started thinking about, well, what else could they want, you know? And I started thinking about, well, you know, they'd want mystical artifacts. And then that led to the issue of like, well, I could have a character. At one point I went through a process of they could be a group that like, you know, will trade magic and magical artifacts. But that ran into the problem of only people who can hire them are people that know that, you know, that have that sort of like, you know, have access to those things. And it was a neat idea, but it was not quite as wide as James wanted it. And also as I wanted it once I kind of figured out what he wanted. And so then I came to the idea of like, I went back to the classic sort of Faustian bargain, and it was like, okay, they want souls. Anybody can hire them if you're willing to sell your soul. And, you know, you're willing to give them something that will get them more souls somehow. And that, you know, that really created, that really did make them then mystical mercenaries in the sense that like anybody, you know, if you need help and you can find them and you're willing to sell your soul, maybe you can hire the Octobermen. And that
really,
was,
really
you know,
need to
and
say
then
that
of course,
the way
once
A-team,
I hit on that
the
soul
narrator
sort of,
does.
Yeah. Once I hit on that soul thing, then of course the characters took, I think, a slightly darker turn just by I think they had to on some level. Because, you know, because not just from the idea of, you know, they're led by a guy who's trying to accumulate souls for his own purpose, but also what, you know, who hires a guy with that, if that's the cost, you know, it's gotta be, you don't hire him for robbing a bank or something. I mean, you don't, it's just not what you, I mean, I guess there might be some short-sighted individuals, and I'm sure that deal's been made a few times over the years. You know, the guy wants a ton of wealth and he sells his soul for it, and they go like rob a bank or like, you know, get him a bunch of money and drop it at his feet and say, well, you know, we'll see you in 10 years or whatever the contract says. But I think more often it's a darker, you know, what do you want? And so even the adventure seeds have, you know, examples of guys who, you know, they either because they really want something or because they're not thinking clearly or whatever, they make that deal. And then the question is, I like groups that give player characters some moral dilemmas, but don't make it too difficult. Like, I'm never a big fan in superhero games of things that are like, you know, these like, aha, no matter what you do, you lose because you're heroes. But I do like the idea that, you know, there is a viable option, I guess, in a few of these, you know, uses of these characters where someone might look at a guy and go, well, you kind of got yourself into this, you know? Like, we're going to stop him from doing this thing because it's going to harm innocence, but we're not really concerned about you, guy who hired them, you know? Then, well, I'm going to lose my soul. It's like, well, you kind of have it coming. So, you know, that's possible. You could have a more sort of Iron Age-y attitude group could say that, or heck, even not even Iron Age. I mean, that was Batman's attitude during the Bronze Age a lot, you know, when he would run into something, not even mystical, but he would run into something where a character, you know, you kind of made this bet and you're going to have to lie in it. And, you know, and I think we see that reflected in Batman Begins with sort of the oft-quoted, you know, I'm not going to kill you, but I don't have to save you. And I think that's butting up against, you know, old-fashioned superheroism a little bit. But I think that, you know, but when you're talking about like horror theme, monster theme, mystical stuff, I think you're naturally butting up against that. I mean, even looking back at the old Avengers and JLA stuff that involved like Mordru and the Demons 3 and whatever, I mean, even though it was pretty Silver Age-y, it had a slightly darker cast to it, I think, just because of the subject matter. So that's basically how the Octoberman came to be, in a nutshell. It was just sort of that, you know, mix, and a lot of it was a shout out back to my loves of the old magic and horror comics of the 70s and early 80s. And less so my love of the when they, I mean, I love that they tried to bring them back in the 90s with Midnight Suns and stuff, but I was a little less enamored. But it was, yeah, I certainly do applaud the idea, though. That was actually, I mean, I was, when that happened in the 90s, I was thrilled at seeing what they were trying, and I was kind of like, eh, but I certainly wasn't upset that that these characters keep making comebacks, because I think that's, you know, like Dracula just showed up not too long ago in Captain Britain and MI-13, bad guy. And it was, I like that because I think he's kind of a classic. Well, he is a classic. I mean, even Meets Masterminds has the Threat Report of Dracula. Mm-hmm. He's a classic bad guy. It even kind of sort of shows up in the Octoberman sort of story, but in a very odd way. But
yeah.
I'm not sure I want to spoil for folks who have not read it, but let me say that Dracula both, he comes up in a way that is both incredibly faithful to his literary roots and also kind of weird. So,
yeah, one of the things I liked about it, and it's actually kind of the basis for one of the characters in the next Do Vigilance, yeah, which actually, we have, I'm not sure if this is going to be issue 2 of Do Vigilance, but I that's currently the plan, but it kind of depends on when certain artwork gets done and when another project gets done. But, yeah, my goal is to have the second issue of Do Vigilance be Black Chapter, which are related to, they're not, it's not a direct tie-in per se. I mean, there's some characters, yeah, that are definitely have it in relationships to characters in the Octoberman.
One in,
but it's not like you can,
two in particular. Actually.
Yeah, you don't have to have both books.
Yeah.
But if you do, you can kind of see where the connections are.
Also,
but
Black Chapter is a little less of a villain group and more of a organization. They're a little more like S.H.I.E.L.D. often gets used in comics, mm-hmm, these days. They're either a help or a hindrance depending on, you know, the themes and the stories that people want to tell with them.
Yeah, so they're a mystic version of S.H.I.E.L.D., and that's kind of what, you know, I really liked. We had so much fun working on the Octoberman, and I just love drawing monsters. So I'm shameless. It's like I love werewolves and monsters and vampires and zombies and stuff. So just wanting to run with that energy, you know, we talked about it, and Jack came back with Black Chapter, which is a sequel to a pseudo sequel in, yeah, a way, to the ideas that were born in.
They're very complementary to each other, yeah, and yeah, they're not necessary to each other, but they're very complementary. And the characters, you know, the characters in Black Chapter have their own stories and own adventure seeds and ideas and things you can do. But if you have both, you're definitely going to get some you're going to see some utility, and you're also going to see that if you choose to use both of these in your setting, then you're going to have a little corner of your universe that's going to be, you know, fairly well fleshed out and have some interesting stories pop up. Mm-hmm. Because they do have some interplay with each other, and they do work together, and they work well. They don't work together at all. That's actually part of the thing. They work against each other. It also, you know, it there's a few bits in there with Black Chapter that I like that sort of, you know, there's a lot of sort of subtle world building that's totally optional. Mm-hmm. That I, you know, that's thrown in there, like, you know, okay, well, you know, obviously for this character to exist, then this thing has to exist in the setting. But, you know, just because it exists in the setting doesn't mean it ever comes up. You know, this one character's appearance could be the only time that you address this particular type of creature or this particular, you know, idea or whatever. And actually, Black Chapter has a few of those. Now that I'm thinking about it, there's actually, I think there are three characters in particular that sort of introduce an idea to the setting that, you know, could either be a great basis for a PC or another NPC, or, you know, you might just never use it. You might just say, "Yeah, good enough. I really like this character, but I don't want to expand on that." And that also works too. So,
yeah. But, so basically, the what Black Chapter is sort of a special forces, special operations group of this mystical branch of this mystical organization called the Library, and the Library is essentially offered as a setting facet that the GM can use. It's a mystic kind of version of S.H.I.E.L.D., but they're not aligned to a government. They have their own organization outside the government. And one of the things I really liked about it was that you laid the groundwork for making them either something that the GM can use against the players as like a constant thorn in their side, mm-hmm. or the players could even be members. You actually have the perks listed so that, you know, if the GM wants to make that available to the players, they can actually buy different levels of membership within the library and get their library card.
Yeah, it's their library card, which are a little more useful probably than your standard library card.
Yes.
Not that I'm not saying libraries and library cards are awesome, but most of them will not let you communicate mystically with other people.
And yes, we do have stats for that in the book.
So there's a lot of fun stuff like that. And I mean, they are kind of, I think at one point I said to James, and we kind of knocked this back and forth as a description, the Black Chapter is kind of like a mystical version of the Suicide Squad. And they are kind of intentionally made in that sort of framework. They're not like, you know, you're not going to be able to look at them and go, "Oh, that's Rick Flag," and that's, you know, well, you might be able to do it with Rick Flag. You're not going to be able to do it with most of the characters and say, "Well, that's Nemesis, and that's Nightshade, and that's Captain Boomerang." But they are designed to fill that sort of role. And, you know, people, you know, that, which, and much like the Suicide Squad, they could either be this, you know, don't do things the way your heroes do, but you are on the same side group. Or they could be this, we have to fight them because they've gone too far group. And, you know, that could even also take place if you were playing in, you know, if you played members of the Library, another team within them. These guys could be the, you know, your allies. They could be your rivals. They could end up being your enemies. You know, there could be a schism within the organization. I mean, there's a lot of stuff you can do with it. And also, you know, included are, you know, there's some interesting, you know, ideas. And as I often do, I'm seeding a lot of ideas, you know, that are possible if people want to use them. Like, you know, there's some pulpy sort of stuff back there that, you know, speaks back to this, or, you know, past history of the setting. And if you want to use that, great. If not, then it's kind of just glaze over it. But there's a lot of that sort of stuff, you know, seeded throughout it. And Aquaman had a bit. I'd say Black Chapter has even more. So.
Yeah, and certainly has a bit more content too. There's more, since this was actually in our we need to make it a little bigger this time kind of phase. We actually had the benefit of starting off with some more fluff and crunch, I guess. Yeah. I should say. There's a lot more going on in that book. So that'll be fun. Right now we're in the middle of layout on Jason Tondreau's Field Guide to Superheroes. Really excited about that. But in the realm of stuff that Vigilance Press is not publishing, Jack Norris is also very active outside. And I should really get back to this because I think some people were tuning in expecting to hear us talk about it. We've been talking for a half an hour about Vigilance Press stuff. And really, there's a lot more to talk about. So I will kind of bring that up in a future podcast, some other stuff that we plan to do. including something I will mention to you guys now by name, but I will describe later, and that is a project that Jack and I are working on called Elements of Ruin. Mm-hmm. It's part of a series of projects we plan to do called Event Horizons. And we'll be talking more about that, but that's going to be the biggest book as far as a superhero supplement that that we've done at Vigilance since I took over.
It's pretty beefy.
Yeah, and it's a really exciting project. I've been tossing ideas back and forth with Jack. I've been basically speaking in pictographs, you know, just sketching ideas. And then, you know, Jack just goes, yes, I love it, or no, what are you talking about, you know? And but that is shaping up, and we should be able to start full-blown production on that very shortly, but he's been writing like a madman for that one. Yep. And I'm kind of hoping that one will hit late summer, but I'm not going to put a date on that.
It might
just
be late
yet.
This year. We'll have to see. I mean, as James said, it's a big project, and there's a lot to it. And
we may even bring that one to a Kickstarter.
We don't want to cut out content of what we intended to put into it, you know, mm-hmm. some sort of, you know, release date when, you know, and also as James has mentioned, there's a lot of, I mean, he didn't even mention Jason Tondra, but he's got a Do Vigilance project coming out too. And,
right,
you know,
Arthur Lives.
Other stuff coming. Then the Forgotten Five as well.
Yeah, and so the Forgotten Five. Yep. We got Forgotten Five coming out.
Yeah.
Jesse Justice is working on the art, and I'll mention more about that because I'm going to have Jason Tondro actually come on the show later this week.
There's definitely stuff coming. So there's another project that James and I have discussed doing that I think is probably can't say much more about at all other than we've discussed doing it. But there's been some development on that as well. So I guess
some more World War II stuff for Icons fans.
Oh yeah, we can talk about that. I mean, basically, we are going to. There's going to be a. For Icons, and I think eventually for Mutants Masterminds, there will be a book called The Beta Men. At least that's the working title. I'm fine with that title. James may change his mind. But basically, it's sort of a aliens and sci-fi and sort of, you know, like a little bit of X-Files and a little bit of Flash Gordon. I think that's probably be my best sort of elevator pitch to describe that would be if you took Flash Gordon
if you're looking for some future space Nazis to introduce to your World War II superheroes because the regular flavor Nazis are just not interesting enough anymore. You covered.
Like alien serving space Nazis. Crazy giant monsters and bug-eyed aliens and, you know, guys in really bad human disguises and things like that, you know, that still manage to somehow walk around in their trench coats and overcoats and be a threat to, you know, there is definitely some definite nods to sort of the 40s and 50s sci-fi, particularly the 50s sci-fi. And it is something that's basically, you know, designed to be that sort of thing. And again, maybe not really like this. I don't want people to think this is like my theme or anything, but more of just trying to provide people options. It includes a sort of a government group, and it also includes some threats. And the government group is kind of designed to be that mix of, you know, these guys could be on, you know, you're all on the same team, you're fighting the Axis, and you're fighting for, you know, but they could also be sort of they could be a thorn in your side too, depending on how the heroes want to run things. And I think that's a common theme in comics that I think, you know, has been going on for a long time. I mean, I think you could even make the argument that while Siegel and Schuster didn't explicitly. You know, spell this out during the early days of Superman, they did have Superman going after like corrupt war profiteers and things like that. You know, sort of the idea that even guys who are nominally on your side, like, you know, like industrialists, you know, in your country or whatever, might not always be on your side. And I think that's actually a fairly long running theme. And so there's those elements, and, you know, trying to provide characters that can both be like these awesome ally heroes that you just want to go up and give a big hug whenever after they help you like defeat a giant alien or whatever, but also could be a guy that you're like, man, you know, I know we're on the same side, but we're never going to see eye to eye. And trying to design those characters is a little tricky sometimes, but it's fun. Hmm. So,
yep. And actually that one, you just turned in the manuscript for that one just recently, but, getting back to the reason that a lot of people I'm sure have tuned in, Jack has also been working on some real comic book properties and not just our fantasy ones that I wish were comic books. More on that later, but much later, but, we are plotting something.
We only have so many hands.
Yeah. but anyway, you are actually working on both of the major comic book properties that have been that have been game-ized lately.
And I think I am the guy. Aaron Sullivan was also working on some stuff as well, so I guess he's the other guy. But yeah, I guess I am the guy. Like, if you pull open DC Adventures, particularly Heroes and Villains, and you pull open Marvel, you're going to see my name. You know, you're going to get sick of seeing my name. So,
so we've got just briefly mention Heroes and Villain. Marvel Heroic Role Playing from Margaret Weiss Productions. We've done a demo podcast where I butchered the rules, and
you didn't do too bad. You didn't.
Hopefully, we can get you on to show us how to do it right. But one thing that people are asking about, and that constantly comes up because they made a lot of promise about how many books is coming out. It's like, what's coming out next? What's on the production schedule? So what have you been working on with Cameron Banks over at Marvel?
We've been working on the Civil War event book. Mm-hmm. Which is the first big book. It's going to come out in two versions. You can get the I don't want to say soft cover, but I think it's maybe soft cover. But you can get just the event book if you've already got the Heroes the main rule book and you don't want to mess with it. Or there's going to be a deluxe version that will include the rules. So if you either just really like having an extra copy of the rules lying around, you really like the deluxe hardcovers, or you know you're looking for a slightly less expensive option, you can either get the Civil War event or the deluxe version with the rules. The way the event structure works is it is designed to let you play through your own version of an event. So Civil War being, you know, when there was a Registration Act and such, and everybody, all heroes ended up on different sides. It'll be designed to let you play through it however you want. You know, Captain America can decide that he wants everybody to register, where in fact in the regular comics he was against it. And Iron Man could decide the opposite, where in fact he was for it. You'll play characters in your own characters as well if you want. It's funny. Marvel's hard for me to describe this in without going on and on and on. And even then, I probably wouldn't get to a satisfying answer. But something about the Marvel game makes me want to play those characters, and I am not the only person who has said that. I've heard a lot of people say that normally they would never. You know, I'd want to make my own character. I want to make my own character. You know, of course I want to make my own character. I don't mind playing in a universe with these other characters, but I want to make my own. And there's just something about the Marvel character that makes it awesome to play Spider-Man. Or, you know, to play Iron Man or whatever. And so the Civil War event books are kind of around that. But however, for folks who are planning on playing their own characters, even in their own universe, there will also be lots and lots of characters to, you know, establish characters to use as models. You know, each one of them, there's going to be, I don't think I'm spoiling anything because I know Cam's listed them all. There's going to be 30 playable characters that are going to be updated, and they're going to be the versions of those characters you see around the time of Civil War. So they may not be perfectly the match of your personal favorite version of a character because it's what that character was like at the time. But, you know, they're not going to be grossly different either. Those characters are going to be there, and they'll all have their, you know, powers and special effects and limits and milestones and the whole nine yards. And then there'll be a lot of minor characters that'll be fleshed out in the more abbreviated format that's used for like NPCs, but still has all the full powers and everything. So those are much like the Heroes and Villains stuff for DC. A lot of people I know have said that that stuff is great because it even if you're running your own game, it gives you a lot of material to use. You know, either by just filing the serial numbers off of a character and using it for your own NPC that's very similar to an existing comic character. Or just saying, you know, I can actually give a completely separate example. A friend of mine is using Marvel Heroic Role Playing to run his fantasy game. He switched from D&D 4th edition to Marvel because he wanted something a little more freeform and a little more epic and feel without, you know, quite as many codified abilities. And when the I was there sort of lending a helping hand when the players were converting their characters over. And one of the things that I noticed was a lot of players were looking at going, you know, looking at an ability on an existing character sheet like Beast or Captain America or whatever, and saying, you know what, I want to change this milestone slightly and that's for my guy. You know, or I want to change this power effect just a little bit and like that's how my guy deals with this situation. And so I'm a big fan of examples, and I think that that's in a lot of ways what Civil War is going to provide you with, is a ton of examples. It's also going to provide you with an example of how to run a big, huge event yourself. So even if you don't like Civil War, you don't want to play it, you don't want to deal with it, but you really want to run like Atlantis attacks or Acts of Vengeance or something, you know, like that, you're going to get the structure on how that's going to be put together. And you're going to get a lot of characters that probably appear in both because, you know, that's how comics work in Marvel. So that's what we're doing right now. And then coming up, there's going to be another event book for Marvel Annihilation, which is Abnett and Lanning's love child of cosmic adventure, which I'm a big fan of. And that will also get a big event book. And then they're also going to do Age of Apocalypse for X-Men. I don't believe any other event books have been announced past that. And I don't know the details of the license because it's not my thing. But I do know that it's not as ironclad as the Green Run and DC license was. It's not just four books, you know, because I do know that Cam has talked about being able to do like downloadable PDFs and stuff for people that he can provide. You know, like bring, because for example, Thor and Hulk are going to be provided that thusly because they're not in Civil War, but it'd be kind of sad to not have them out in some form for people to use with the Avengers movie, you know, looming in the near future.
Very, very near future. By the way, I don't know if you have yours yet, but I already have my tickets.
I have my tickets like today. So yeah, we are all for that. I am all about the Avengers movie. Actually, Tom Hiddleston, the guy who plays Loki, wrote a fantastic. It was either he wrote it or it was an interview and somebody transcribed it. A fantastic defense of superheroes in the genre, both in film and just as a concept. And why he thinks they're important and why he thinks they're fun and why, you know, people who tend to sneer at comics and comic book movies, you know, maybe they should give it another thought. And it was really, really interesting to listen to this very, like, very serious Shakespearean-trained actor who takes his work very seriously, you know, talk passionately about modern mythology and, you know, commonalities of the audience understanding certain concepts and, you know, sort of the drama, and it was. I think he did it for Empire. I could be wrong, but it's out there somewhere if you find it on the internet, and it's definitely worth a read if you're like me and interested in that sort of, you know, not looking at comics and movies and stuff in that fashion and giving them a little bit more. You know, if nothing else, it's a great thing to pull out in defense if one of your, you know, like, you know, highfalutin, like, you know, literature grad student friends or whatever starts staring at you for being excited to go see the Avengers. You can pull that out and be like, ha. Though that would be funny because I'd also just point him at Jason Tondro at this point. So that would be
Doctor Comics. Not to mention the fact that, you know, I myself am also the literature major.
Yeah, the two or three other professors I know who love comics. But yeah, it's just a
Professor Christopher McLaughlin.
Yes, exactly, Professor Christopher McLaughlin. I know a couple other folks too. I know a few folks aren't professors, but at least have their masters. So yeah,
I love being able to call Christopher Professor now. That's just awesome.
Professor M. It's our. Yeah. Professor McG. Not to be confused with the other guy who does movies and stuff.
Yeah. And a shout out to Christopher. I'm still waiting for my season box set of McG and the Bully. we'll get into that next time. Okay. I have.
But anyway, briefly back to Marvel. I was kind of got segued because we started talking about Avengers, and I got excited because I do. One of the cool things about the coming up too is we're going to be doing supplements for each one of the event books. Will get three supplements, and each one of those supplements will expand and expound upon the setting, and will provide you with more characters and more options and more stuff. Civil War is going to have an X-Men supplement, which is going to deal with all that, because most of the X-Men weren't very involved in Civil War, but they did do some stuff, but they were doing a lot of stuff at that time of their own. So you know, all your X-Men contemporary to that time period are going to pop up in there. And there was the Young Avengers Runaways, which is going to include a lot of the younger heroes, also the anti-Reg stuff. And then the Initiative, which will include members of the Initiative and other groups of that sort, and the more pro-Reg stuff. So there's already going to be a very big, beefy number of new characters and such in Civil War. But if you're looking at something and going, my God, where's this character? Well, don't panic, because there's a decent chance he's not only going to be coming, but if he's a big enough character, he's probably getting a full write-up and a full character, you know, big, full, nice, you know, player character sheet for him. maybe not in all the obscure characters, but I've lobbied for a few obscure characters, so I know I probably made myself annoying in some cases to Cam and Co. With my repeated insistence on, like, you know, including guys like Goliath, Bill Foster, and such as playable characters, and saying that he had to, like, you know, no, he can't just die. He has to be in there. You have to have the option of him not dying, and, you know, that's like, that would be like the greatest example of your Civil War event being different if the guy whose death, like, caused all these schisms didn't die. And other characters like that. Also some characters that weren't involved with Civil War, but wouldn't it have been cool if they were? So there's a couple of those thrown in there too. So there's a little bit of a what-if element to it. And I guess in a lot of ways, that's what the Marvel event books are all about. It's like doing your own what-if, you know, with what if Captain America, you know, decided to be pro-registration in Civil War? What if all the heroes had decided they were against registration and it was just S.H.I.E.L.D., you know? What if Mr. Fantastic had, you know, not come up with his crazy reason for why he was in favor of it and wasn't or whatever? And that's my one critique of Civil War I will throw out without getting into too much details. I do think some of the justifications for heroes being on one side or the other are a little weak. And Mr. Fantastic, unfortunately, was probably the weakest one, I think, because it was basically resulted in two math.
Yeah, I know. It was just like, you know,
math and the Red Scare. And I wish I was joking. I wish I was joking that math and the Red Scare were his two big reasons.
Yeah.
But his two big reasons involved math and the Red Scare. And I was kind of like, it was definitely, but it's fun. It's a lot of fun to work on. The event structure actually, I think, is really cool. And it's a lot of fun to do. Even if you don't, you know, run Civil War itself, I think it's got some great advice on how to do that. There'll also be some talking about, this isn't my category of what I'm working on, so I can't speak on it too much, but there's going to be talking about, you know, when an event is particularly focused on a particular thing like cosmic phenomenon or sort of, you know, warring factions or whatever, there's going to be some discussion on how to work that into with the game rules and such, which also means that, you know, these are, it's not going to be like there's a bunch of new rules, but there are going to be new things, you know, to use and think about and such. So, and also, you know, there are going to be characters that, you know, like, for example, the main Marvel game, there was not a big mystical character in the playable heroes. It just wasn't. I mean, there were the rules on sorcery and such, but there wasn't. And Civil War is going to, you know, introduce the concept of Doctor Strange as a playable character. And so you're going to get, more mystical examples and ideas and stuff for folks wanting to do that. And ditto for Annihilation and Aliens and such. So I kind of liken it to the old Marvel game had those big books about, like, the Avengers and the X-Men and whatever, but instead of having those and then the little adventures, it's like they kind of take the book about the characters and then, you know, put in a, like, here's an event you can run along with it. So it's a little bit of a different structure, but instead of getting, like, you know, an occasional big source book and a lot of small little modules, you're going to get basically a source book with a sort of event on it as well. But it's pretty cool, and we're going to be doing those, and there's going to be a fair number of them. Like I said, there's going to be three for Civil War and three for Annihilation and three for Age of Apocalypse and plus the main books each. So that's 12 books right there. So
got plenty of stuff coming.
And I should probably be working on all those to some degree or another. So that's I'm on their what they call the Advanced Idea Mechanics team. So I'm a member of AIM. So, you know, my head is not big enough to be a member of AIM, barely, but I can't.
The beekeeper hat? Did they give you the beekeeper hat?
They did not give me a beekeeper hat, nor do I have a little floaty chair to carry around my tiny little body. but we're sort of the rules character sort of guys, you know, sort of assistant. I think we're assistant design group or something. I'm technically, I like the Marvel comic, you know, nickname though. So that's kind of fun. But and you will see us, I think, even credited as such in the books. I think we are credited as the Advanced Idea Mechanics, which is, and then of course our names are listed as well. But no, it's pretty fun. And Marvel, I like the Marvel system. It's very different than Mutants Mastermind. It's very different icons. It's more of a comic book simulator, if I had to describe it in a very short period of time. And it simulates sort of comic-y action, and focuses more on that and less on a more traditional RPG sort of style. And you know, but has some neat little tactical options and things for folks who want it. One of the things, actually, I think that I like the most about it is that you know, you can have two guys sitting next to each other at a table, and one just wants to roll the dice and have fun, and the other one wants to get very fiddly with what he does and wants to set everything up. And I think the play supports both. You know, you can have that fun with it, so it's cool. It's a fun system. It's a cool idea. It's you know, folks are great to work with, and you know, the books are all very, very pretty. They're very well put together and very, very, very physically attractive to look at and hold. And they will fit nicely right next to your graphic novels if you're a big comic fan, because they're sized in that sort of they're like a graphic novel size print. So,
yep.
I can't say if the hardcovers will be, but I do. But I imagine so. But I do know that the small covers. So that's enough about Marvel, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm just thinking that, you know.
We should probably give some love to the other side of the pond.
Yeah, the other side. You keep mentioning Mutants and Masterminds and comparing it. And one of the things that you kept bringing up with Marvel that I really liked was the idea of the examples. And two of the major example books that are out in PDF form, one's out in book form, and the other one's pending. Are the collection,
yes.
For DC Adventures, the Mutants and Masterminds system version of all the famous DC superheroes, all the iconic versions.
Yep.
We have the Heroes and Villains Volume 1 is out, and the book is out, and the PDF has been released for Heroes and Villains Volume 2, and you know, they're in the process of getting the book published and printed. I'm not sure where I'm not sure how much I can say about that.
I think John said at one point that it was at print, but do not quote me on that. I think that he mentioned that on the Atomic Think
Tank. Well, it's kind of hard not to quote since we're recording you.
No, I said, don't rely on that. That's pure hearsay. I have no idea. And my memory may be terrible. But I think it's in that process somewhere.
Yeah, but one of the popular podcasts we did when the last book came out, we basically had Jack sit down and do a marathon session talking about each of the characters he worked on, but it ended up being like a 2.5 hour podcast.
It was very, very long.
So I think this time what we're going to do is we're just going to kind of cover some highlights. And if anybody has any specific questions that they'd like to add to it later,
next time I'm on, I will gladly talk about it.
We can always expand on it. Yeah. But you know, one thing I did have a question that just popped up. I think this is Nathan, our editor, being a smartass.
No, of course.
but you know, this kind of ties into a common criticism, so I can use this as an introduction to that. He says, Jack, on page 12 of Redacted, you have redacted with a rank 12 redacted in redacted array. shouldn't that be redacted and applicable to redacted when he redacted?
That sounds like Nathan.
But I think
talks like that all the time. Seriously, you have no idea how hard it is to figure out what he's saying when he says redacted all the time. He thinks he's being watched by someone, and my people are too busy too, so I don't know why he thinks that. But
no, seriously though, I mean, a lot of people look at the books and then they crack them open and they see a character that doesn't necessarily match up to their expectations of the character.
I actually have a personal example of this I can use. Mm-hmm. Recently, it was asked on the Atomic Think Tank about the question, which I'll segue into, because the question was the one entry, one of a few entries I personally requested to do, and I will talk about briefly why in a moment. And he had an unarmed combat of +17, which is pretty high. It's pretty good.
Yeah.
I'm not saying anything wrong, but pretty good. And somebody was saying, you know, it don't seem like that. Why did you have to optimize the character, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then I was reading the person's description, and I realized that he was most familiar with the version from Justice League Unlimited, because the examples he was giving about, you know, well, this character had this happen to him, this character had this happen to him, this character had this happen to him, and, you know, he wasn't able to fight this guy off, so why wouldn't that, you know? And I'm thinking, and I'm looking at it going, that is a valid complaint, but we're not doing that version. You know, that's not the Justice League Unlimited version is not the version of the question that I, you know, that was iconic and put into iconic in the comics that was put into the book. The version of the question was iconic and put into the book, was heavily inspired by Denny O'Neill's Question series in the 1980s, which, if people have not read it, I cannot recommend highly enough. And it was actually one of my favorite comics. It probably still is one of my favorite comic series. The Question is, if not my favorite comic character, one of my favorite comic characters. And I actually, that was one of those formative titles. Everybody has those, I think, when you're reading comics for long enough, where, you know, something about the character, something about the story, something about the way it was written, something about the concepts, you know, you read it and it was like, this speaks to me on some level. And The Question was mine. Charlie was mine. Charles Victor Sage is this character's name, given name, and he goes by Vic Sage. And Question has always been that. And he is, you know, but The Question in the comics is trained by Richard Dragon, who's one of the greatest martial artists in the world. And he, you know, he could hold his own, you know, fighting with Batman. He's not really fighting against Batman ever, but fighting with Batman without using a lot of gadgets and stuff. And maybe he's not as good. He's not as good as Batman, but he could at least, you know, make a respectable showing. And, you know, he could team up with Green Arrow and, you know, without a bow and without, you know, weapons and, you know, hold his own. And so making a character that could do that was part of it. You know, it's like, this character needs to be able to do this. You know, Green Arrow's already been written by Steve Kenson and Batman's already been statted out by somebody, you know, by Steve and somebody else. Who, making a guy who can hold his own, you know, Charlie needs to be able to basically, you know, fight Lady Shiva and not win, but at least not completely embarrass himself. And, you know, he needs to be able to, you know, be on par with and slightly better in hand-to-hand combat than the Huntress, because in Huntress Cry for Blood, he encounters her and ends up training her, and they get briefly romantically involved, and then that doesn't work out. And, you know, trying to bring those all into it and then trying to fit them into an iconic version, where sometimes even a favorite version of something you might have to drop because it only showed up once. And that's why, actually, in The Question, I have a sidebar talking about other versions of him when he was younger and less experienced. Whenever I originally had a note, I think, mentioning Rorschach, too, but I think they took it out because Watchmen wasn't part of the license. But for folks who don't know why I'm saying Rorschach, is that Watchmen, Alan Moore based The Watchmen on the old Charlton Comics characters, and The Question was originally a Charlton Comics character created by Steve Ditko, one of the co-creators of Spider-Man, who did a bunch of other stuff for a company called Charlton Comics, and he created a lot of characters who were then later purchased and incorporated into the DC Universe, including Blue Beetle, the Atom, Captain America, Nightshade, and some others. So in a very brief, there is a history of a little bit of history of comic snippet for folks. And so The Question has had a long and varied history. When you're trying to come up with a way to make him work, you know, you have to come up with an iconic version of that character. And what I came up with was the character who is on this sort of path to enlightenment. He is trying to become better than he is. You know, he's searching truth, and truth in a sort of with a capital T. And, you know, he's also, you know, searching for his own identity, which is why he, you know, he has this mask, and half the time he feels like the mask is more him than him. And this all factors in very importantly when he shows up in 52 and ends up basically being replaced by training and befriending and eventually being replaced by Renee Montoya, who becomes the second Question, who's also statted up in the book. And she also is along that path, you know, discovering who she really is. You know, she's not really a cop in Gotham. She's not really Batwoman's girlfriend. She's not really all these things that she is, but that's not all she is. And she's trying to discover who she is. And that's why you see things in those particular write-ups, particularly with Richard Dragon, who is a fairly enlightened individual, and also with Vic. You see things like skill mastery, insight, and such. You know, Batman doesn't have – Batman, who's, you know, the benchmark for everything awesome with trained normals in DC, you know, really, doesn't have skill mastery insight. Because while his insight is very high, you know, he isn't on this sort of philosophical path that The Question is. And so that's also kind of speaks to making characters like that. You know, when you're making Catman and you're making Question and you're making, you know, these other characters that are all, you know, and Connor Hawk, Green Arrow, who's one of the ones I did, and you're trying to make these characters who all basically punch or hit something or, like, use, like, a fairly mundane weapon and make them different. And you know, that's also part of it. You know, you're trying to model not just their fighting styles and, you know, like, oh, they seem to use this, you know, power attack a lot, but you're also trying to see sort of like, you know, oh, well, this character has trance. Well, why does he have trance? Well, because in the comics he's shown meditating deeply and, you know, such, and this isn't a character. The other characters might know how to do it, but, you know, it doesn't come up very often. And, you know, that sort of stuff. And you do it with powers too, but I think you do it, I think it with advantages and skills, it becomes really tricky because they're not the big flashy things. I mean, it's not too difficult to describe what the difference between Superman and Captain Marvel's powers are, even though they're a very similar character in a lot of ways, because, you know, Captain Marvel doesn't have heat vision. He doesn't have, you know, he doesn't have a bunch of super senses, et cetera, et cetera. But when you're trying to sort of, you know, describe the difference between, you know, Batman's sort of like, you know, Eastern philosophy and martial arts as a tool for his own personal mission of vengeance versus the question sort of Eastern philosophy and martial arts as a tool to, you know, carry himself along his sort of pathway, which, you know, which at least for the time when he was the question, being a vigilante was part of it. It creates slightly different characters, and it's kind of fun, but it's definitely in that sort of, you know, weird mix. But yeah, you're not always going to get, you know, some people are going to say, oh, clearly this. And it's like, well, yeah, I mean, if I was modeling the JLU question, which Jeffrey Combs did the voice for, and I really enjoyed, but he's more of a conspiracy nut. You know, he would have had, like, you know, he would have had expertise conspiracies, you know, I mean, he would have had expertise, you know, he would have had definitely different abilities. And, in part, the simple answer for that version is that that character wasn't part of the license that we used. So, you know, that version wasn't used, but also, you know, in various other cases, when you're making certain characters, you might go, oh, well, this character should obviously have this. It's like in that particular version he did, but in this particular version he doesn't. And when possible, there, you know, I think people tried to put sidebars and such in, but you couldn't always make it fit. So
yeah, I did notice that you have a sidebar on the question called Other Questions here.
Yes, which I also just couldn't really pass up for the name Other Questions. So that's something people will notice if they read enough of my writing. I will, in addition to throwing in tons and tons of pop culture quotes and very, very obscure pop culture references and other things like that, I love a good, not even like a pun, I don't know if a pun is exactly the word I would use, but some sort of a play on words. You know, and if I have the option of calling something, you know, Other Questions, or like, this raises a question in the question entry, I will totally do that. I think I actually had Other Questions written or something like that as a sidebar before I even decided what the sidebar was going to be. Because I was like, this has to have a sidebar mentioning questions. Because, which is my own sort of bizarre way of shouting out to the old Denny O'Neill series, where a lot of times when being asked a question or something, he would answer it with a question or with an obscure reference. And so someone would ask you know, like, what's the deal with the no face mask or whatever, you know, some thug had asked me, so that's a good question. And then he wouldn't answer. He wouldn't say anything else. He would just say, that's a good question. And then he would leave it. And, that was sort of a fun little element. The question is also interesting because he is the one entry that I can say with absolute certainty I did not have to consult anything for. I actually spell checked. I mean, I spell checked some stuff. Obviously I fact checked after the fact, but I sat down and wrote the question completely like, boom. I was like, just, I know this character. And, you know, particularly the personality sections and such, I wrote, it was like, I understand Charlie's personality and, you know, at least what I got out of it. And, you know, even with Renee, I had to double check a few things because, you know, some of her, I read Gotham Central, but I missed a few issues along the way. And I also sometimes didn't want to confuse her animated series appearances with her eventual add to the DC Universe, which is actually, speaking of characters with interesting histories, Renee Montoya, the second question, was originally a cop added to the Batman animated series, who they liked enough that they brought into the DC Universe and made her a regular cop. And her partner, her ex-partner, was the Spectre, and, you know, died and got turned into the Spectre, and, you know, she ended up dating Batwoman and coming out as a lesbian. And then started drinking because there were a lot of problems that were caused by various problems in her life. And so she's a recovering alcoholic. And she's got a lot of character to her that is pretty deep. And Greg Rucka in particular has done a lot of work with her as a character. And I think done a really great job with her as a character. And you know, that's actually, if I could probably give Greg Rucka the best praise I could, is that, you know, he replaced my favorite character ever with another character, and I at the end of it, I was like, oh, man. But you know what? That was a really good story. So he managed to completely, you know, subvert any nerd rage I might have had with just pure skill of writing a really good tale. So that was pretty cool.
I have to say that Greg Rucka is currently my hero as far as a writer goes. I've been tuning in weekly to his webcomic, Lady Aether and the Pirates of the Ineffable. I'm sorry, Lady Saber and the Pirates of the Ineffable Aether, which if you haven't read it, it's very kind of steampunk, and the artwork is fantastic. And
Rucka is just fantastic. He wrote his Wonder Woman was fantastic. His his you know, his I love the stuff he did for 52. I love this Question stuff that he did. I love this. He got me back into reading Batman. I was kind of taking a break from Batman. He did Batman No Man's Land.
He made Checkmate really fun.
Oh, made Checkmate really fun. He just really, really great writer. And from what limited experience I've had mostly through other people, he apparently sounds like a real stand up, nice guy to talk to too. Very insightful. Mm-hmm. And I think that comes out in his writing, which is always good.
So we've covered now. You covered the questions. You wrote that entire section on the questions.
Yeah, I wrote that entire section. I actually was sad. I did not have enough space to put Aristotle Rorador in there.
So you also did the stats set block for Richard Dragon. So that's cool.
Did the stats set for Richard. Richard is actually my the My Name Is Richard. The sidebar part of that is actually a quote. When he first meets the Question, he says, "Who are you?" They said, "My name is Richard," or they call me Richard. And it's basically he actually Richard Dragon is one of those characters that was like a kung fu character in the 70s who was later reimagined to be this sort of mentor guru of a bunch of people. He taught Oracle how to fight after she was paralyzed. He taught Vic Sage is probably his most notable pupil, but he's also there's some. Depending on which writer you ask, he also taught Batman. It really depends on Lady Shiva, who most people, are thinking of as like the biggest badass martial artist in all of DC. And I don't mean to, dissuade her status as that, but Lady Shiva originally showed up as a supporting character in Richard Dragon's comic. He was hit her like, her and Ben Turner, who eventually becomes Bronze Tiger, were his like kung fu team. So Richard Dragon may not be a name that everybody immediately latches onto, but he is, in the realm of DC martial artists, he is one of the men, really, he's up there. And, Denny O'Neill took him and made him a really interesting supporting character for the Question in the old series. And he's popped up in sort of that same role mostly since. Chuck Dixon had a brief series with him as more of a main character, but it didn't last very long. And I don't know how much of that is actually canon, particularly with the reboot. So, so that was, I did all the Question stuff. I also wanted to add an Aristotle Rorador, who's, Charlie's sort of, mentor / father figure / sidekicky character, but unfortunately there just wasn't space. And that actually, leads to, so he's mentioned in there under allies, but he didn't have stats. Which leads to something that I think is just a reality of when you've got a book that big and beefy, that sometimes you have to make a decision of what character you're putting in. And, one of the greatest martial artists in the DC universe who's relatively obscure probably should get a stat block over the, inventor guy, as much as the inventor guy is actually a great character who I really, really like. It'd be like if if somebody put a gun to your head and told them you can only include, three supporting characters for Batman. And that you're going to stat up, you're going to be at Robin. You're going to be at the various Robins and Batgirls and stuff before you ever, as much as Alfred is awesome, he may not get a stat block. I think he does, but he might not,
Right.
It's like, Ma and Pa Kent are some of my favorite comic book parents ever, but they may not get stats if it's, them or, Crypto or Superboy or something. So,
And again, there's different reasons behind those choices. Among those reasons are is this character really going to see combat? You going to need these numbers, or do you just need enough background to be able to introduce the character?
And then there's definitely the arguments Alfred's had a few times where he's had to throw down with somebody, and so it'd be kind of nice to have stats on him. The only problem there, of course, is depending on which comic you read, Alfred's either like an ex theater trained ex intelligence badass guy, or he's just a butler. And you run into the same thing over in Marvel side of things with Jarvis.
Mm-hmm.
The people who write Jarvis either as like sort of the old butler who may have been in the war but he's past his prime, and other people write him as Jarvis is like a World War II vet and like hero and former covert operative who went to work for the Stark family, and he's a butler, but you don't want to mess with the dude. So that was kind of that that's another thing too. A lot of those supporting characters get even more variants than than. Probably the greatest example of this is Commissioner Gordon. If you look at the different versions of Commissioner Gordon over the years, you literally have a guy who throws a Green Beret, a baseball bat, to make it a fair fight.
Yeah, I know.
literally, you've got that guy. You're wondering why he's not wearing a costume. Back to the old, not much more competent than the old Batman TV show version, where he was just basically a guy who picked up the phone and said, "Batman, help us." So... and those are, those are the character versions, and which And obviously, you're probably not going to include, you know, with Gordon, you're not going to include that version. But it's still that idea of, you know, the supporting characters probably get a, they get a wider variance even than the heroes do. And the heroes get a pretty wide variance. But yeah, so I did the question. I did Richard Dragon. I did Renee. I was really, you know, Charlie, Renee, and Richard were my three. And actually, this and Marvel, and I will say, it probably, the thing that labels me as a huge comic nerd more than anything else is watching, if folks could see my behind-the-scenes conversations with people when we're talking about design stuff, and, like, the having conversations with people and talking about, like, you know, Captain America and saying Steve, or talking about, like, Black Panther and saying T'Challa. And, you know, I have to remind myself half the time to use the characters, like, you know, because I guess on some level I grew up with these characters, you know? They're kind of like my friends and my family in a sort of weird, you know, not in a completely functional and not insane way, are basically, mm-hmm. you know, they taught me things and I, you know, followed their adventures and, you know, saw them have triumphs and tragedies and, you know, and unlike, you know, your average, you know, TV show or whatever, these characters just have more than one name, so... And it feels more personal, I guess, to call them that. So yeah, that's a thing I'll do a lot. People will see me do it. Like, you know, I always call the question Charlie, because that's what Denny O'Neill always called him, and Greg Rucker always calls him. And I love the idea that now I get to put myself in that very, very elite, you know, even in this incredibly nerdy sort of, like, you know, way of in the same category of guys who got paid to write about the question. So that was actually pretty awesome. And thanks again to John Lighthouse for letting me do it, and you know, about, you know, honoring my request of please let me write the question. Don't make me beg. So yeah, but no, it was cool. It was actually one of my favorite entries, and one I put a lot of thought into.
Okay. And, so let's moving on from that question. I'm just glancing. I'm gonna jump to a question from Jason Tondro. Actually, he posted this on Facebook, and then we can, you know, you can. I'm gonna take you on a little sidetrack here, which will probably take us another 20 minutes, and then you can come back and talk some more about the characters you worked on.
Okay, cool.
But he asks you. He presents you with a hypothetical.
Okay.
Here, Jack. You just found out that you are GMing 5 new Mutants and Masterminds players who have made power level 10 heroes.
Okay.
You have 5 minutes to assemble a villain team to fight them in a 3-hour DC Adventures session tonight. Who do you pick?
Okay. All right. Well, the obvious answer to this is it depends. But I'm going to say briefly why it depends, and then I'm actually going to give an answer. I don't know anything about the campaign or the setting, so, like, you know, if this is like the 30th century or whatever, then obviously you Fatal Five and you just move on. But assuming it's a modern day campaign, and we're talking relatively standard, you know, power level 10 heroes, you know, and then there's no special thing I'm aware of, like, you know, oh, are these guys are mostly mystic or they're all teen heroes or whatever, probably gonna go with Brotherhood of Evil. That would be my one. If I had to pick one just out of nowhere, probably be the Brotherhood of Evil. Just because I think that they just fond memories of them fighting the Teen Titans back in the day, and then now that most of the Titans are the adult Titans are around power level 10, I think that the Brotherhood is mostly around that too. A good follow-up to them, or a good possible follow-up, are some of the ones that I don't think are quite as often used, like the Masters of Disaster and some of those other characters. But I would probably, those characters aren't quite as cool and quite as well used for a reason. So I would probably go for the Brotherhood of Evil for power level 10. Power level 11 or 12, even starting characters, that's when you're starting to look at, like, the Injustice gangs and Justice Leagues and stuff, I would say. But if I was going to go for a straight, just right off, like, I know nothing else about this other than villains are going to try to do something, I would say Brotherhood of Evil. Because you've got the brain, so you've got your mastermind who'd be trying to do something evil, and you've got your evil monkey, and who doesn't want, like, an evil monkey? And... you've got Warp who can get them out of there if they need be. So if you need the villain to escape to continue, but also if he gets taken down, they can get captured. Plasmus is actually a really good but sort of different brick. So that'd probably be my first choice. And again, there are times when that is not the right choice. But I would say, you know, these guys fought the Doom Patrol and they fought the Titans a lot. And the combination, slightly different version of the Brotherhood, but still. And, you know, that's a pretty good variance of adult and teen heroes. So if I had to think of a group that, you know, hits around power level 10-ish that can fight guys who are, you know, can fight anything from teen heroes to adult heroes in the DC universe on a quick, you know, most of the other ones have problems of, like, either being too focused on a particular type of character, like Flash's Rogues Gallery, as much as I love them, are a very particular style of group. Mm-hmm. And again, like I said, you know, if we're talking more power level 11 or 10, and if these are, like, new players, too, like, if we had guys who were a little more experienced or whatever, if I thought throwing the occasional power level 11 or 12 or something at them, which wouldn't be a miss, then I would say start looking at Injustice Gang and Justice League. But I would say that for straight out starting power level 10s, I would probably go with the Brotherhood of Evil.
Yeah, it's kind of funny you mentioned the power of Brotherhood of Evil, because I remember very strongly back in the 80s when I was playing the old DC Adventures, or the DC Heroes role-playing game, which does share some pedigree with the DC Adventures game. But the Brotherhood of Evil were kind of my go-to guys.
Oh, they're a good group, right?
Yeah, for games. They were really good villains. They covered a lot of bases. They had really cool artwork for the characters, and
it was also really easy.
They were topical for the Teen Titans, which were my favorite group at the time.
They're also really easy to throw in extra characters. You know, it's not hard to come up with a character that would join either an existing character or your own villain that would join the Brotherhood.
Right.
You know, they basically, oh, I want to have a guy, you know, hey, they don't have anybody who has these powers and, you know, like water-based powers, and I have an idea for a water-based villain. So I'm going to have this guy join the Brotherhood, and, you know, the Brain recruits him, and, like, maybe, you know, and maybe he's, like, a mutant with minor powers, and he, like, augments his power with some sort of process, and now he feels like he owes him one, or maybe he's just a mercenary. I mean, it wasn't hard to get those characters together and get them working. Also, there isn't any weirdness to getting them involved. Like, you know, like, yeah, it's like Fatal Five or something might work, but you have the problem of, you got to get them from the 30th century, which does raise a question, unless you're playing in the 30th century. And if you are playing 30th century, then, you know, anybody else is going to be weird to you, unless you're using Legion villains. But yeah, I would go for the other ones. Why am I blanking on their name?
Well, the one group that I know I've seen, and this is not a group that I would use for a power level 10 game. If I expected the players to win, we were talking about a 3-hour pickup game. I would probably, you know, use the Brotherhood of Evil for power level 10. But if the players were playing power level 11, or I really wanted to stomp them into the ground.
Yeah.
I would probably use the the Fearsome Five. Simon and Simon, Gizmo actually, and Jinx were my Mammoth other, and Shimmer.
They were my other suggestion. They were my follow up suggestion. Like, if I had to pick one, I stand by my Brotherhood of Evil for the first, but Fearsome Five is actually my follow up.
They're just all power level 11, so yeah, they can easily overpower a power level 10 group if the GM is
brutal. And if you've got 5 versus 5 and you're giving somebody an extra power level, I mean, I think that's the problem there I see. However, setting that aside for a second, either scale them down a power level and they work great conceptually. I mean, they do work great conceptually. They make a really good, you know, here are some villains doing something bad.
Or really help the players take advantage of their complications. Right,
or exactly. Or take them out to throw some extra hero points for fighting something that they're a little outclassed by or whatever. But yeah, I would go Brotherhood of Evil, both of my follow-up would actually be Fearsome Five would be my follow-up. Because they're actually, again, another really good, solid, you know, middle-of-the-road villain group. There's not anything, you know, they haven't had, like, you know, they've done some cool stuff here and there. But what they have going for them is they're a good, solid group of bad guys.
Yeah, they're kind of a group of almost rans too. So it's like everybody knows about them, but you know, no, but not everybody knows them well enough to basically plan the entire combat the moment they find out who they're fighting.
Yeah, exactly. You're not sitting there going, okay, well, I do X, Y, and Z because that's how I win them against these guys.
Yeah.
But
so let's get back to the characters that you've actually written for Volume 2. Cool. You had another story you wanted to bring in.
Yeah. So, interestingly enough, I also worked on Warlord, which I didn't request. But the only reason I didn't request Warlord is I didn't think to request Warlord. I wasn't sure that he was going to be in there. I thought he might show up in DC Universe or whatever. So I kind of just left it open and was like, well, if I get it, you know, if he's confirmed, maybe I'll ask. Because I read a lot of the old Travis Morgan Warlord comics as a kid. Really loved them. Mike Grell's stuff.
run them particularly, but even the stuff that eventually, like, I can't remember who took over for him right off the top of my head, but... And Warlord was funny because I did Warlord, and I got this note from John saying, you know, or some sort of message to the effect of, work as many of the supporting cast as you can work in. And, you know, give them the minor stat blocks. I managed to get them all in. I was very... Deimos, the bat, his big bad guy, didn't get in. Or actually, I did stats on him, but he got cut. But I even said, look, you're going to cut somebody, cut the villain, and keep all supporting cast. And Deimos might show up, and I'm guessing might show up in DC Universe or something, in Kataris or something. He might not. But I actually sat down and was like, okay, if I can do this, I want to do like Shakira and Machiste and Tinder and everybody and get those all in there. And it was fun because it was the ability to do a single entry that actually turned out to be sort of a team entry. And it was also fun because it was kind of a, you know, being sort of a sword and sorcery character in the DC Universe, it was kind of like my own version of like Warriors and Warlocks or whatever. in micro, because one of them's a sorcerer, you know, his daughter Jennifer is a sorcerer, and... You know, he's like, a, you know, Travis is like a, you know, a pistol packing, sword wielding, you know, warrior guy. And, you know, his son, Tinder, is sort of a thiefish, sort of sneakier guy. And Machiste is sort of a big brawly guy with like a mace for a hand. And, you know, Shakira is like a thief that can turn into a cat. And, you know, it's just kind of having that sort of fun sort of, you know, fantasy group in there. And I also just, I'm a big fan of Travis Morgan's Warlord. I was really, really like that character. I really liked the... recent series that Mike Grell brought back. I will not speak of the Bruce Jones series because we will not speak of that. It was. I am verily. It takes a lot to invoke what the hell are you doing, nerd rage in me with comics. It really does. I'm very sort of, well, you know, that's what they were doing, you know. And I just don't even know. Like, it was... I don't know where to start on that, so I won't start. But the but anybody who was like thinking about like, oh, Warlord sounds neat. It's like a Conan-ish sort of a fantasy Earth's Core side of thing. But yeah, do yourself a favor. Get the Showcase Warlord that like introduces him. Get the more recent trades, and for God's sakes, like avoid anything that says like Bart Sears Bruce Jones like on the cover for like because that series was just ugh. And again, I think Bart Sears is actually a pretty good choice to draw Warlord with all the crazy rippling muscles and whatever, but it just didn't work out. And actually, it'll fool you because the first issue or so is actually pretty decent, and then it just goes on this whatever. And then the last issue, I believe, is actually, if I recall correctly, has like sort of a apology slash, you know, we're resetting it back to how it was, you know, and what you're used to, which was actually pretty good, but it was that problem of, you know, by the end of it, you're like, wow, the writer could have written a story I would have liked. He just chose not to for like 12 issues, and then it got canceled. But yeah, so Warlord was a personal favorite of mine. It's also fun to make a character, you know, that is basically, he's shown up. And I think most people nowadays will be familiar with him from his episode of Justice League Unlimited, which was a great episode. It was a really great episode. And but you know, that's that character, if folks are wondering, where they go to like the alternate realm with like, I think it's like Supergirl and...
Yeah, Supergirl was having problems with her powers. Yeah. They found a giant kryptonite rock that was kind of a plot point there.
And they had a big fight and big, like, you know, liberate the land from the evil Deimos, the bad guy.
And Stargirl was being a real...
Well, she was jealous of Supergirl, and Supergirl, yeah. Supergirl wasn't handling it very well. The two of them ironed it out by the end of it, and then they were. So it was definitely a teaching something episode. It was it was definitely in cartoons they have those. So you learned a lesson of something, you know, which is kind of cool.
Yep.
What I always
like, I mean, and of course, I think I discovered Warlord back in the 70s. I don't remember exactly when I read it, and I don't think I read it religiously. It was one of those books where I'd see it occasionally, I'd pick it up, and you know, it's like an early teenager, I'm like, ooh, scantily clad ladies. I was like, I always did have
plenty of those.
Yeah, I always liked the Catgirl Shakira because I just thought it was a really cool concept that they didn't spoil the mystery. They would never really explained, is this a girl or is this a cat?
Yeah, and they would often make it think one or the other. I actually always liked that about Shakira too. I also one neat thing that's kind of fun about Warlord too is that it had these sort of Shakira and Skataris, the land, had this sort of weird time dilation thing which would sort of allow the stories to be told in sort of this whatever the narrative needs way. That was, I always thought, was a really neat idea. And one of the things, for example, there was one bit where one of the characters and meets up with Warlord, and she goes and she gets like, you know, she goes and gets like new clothes, and she like, you know, gets a sword because she had a gun, but it's not working anymore, and some other stuff, and, you know, has a bath and et cetera. And then she comes out and, you know, Travis has like grown his beard back or whatever for it. He lost or whatever. And she's like, "Oh, how'd your beard back?" And he goes, "Yeah, it's been like a week. You know, I like slept three times, like five times and eaten several times and whatever." And he's like, "What? I was only in there for," it's like, "Yeah, time just works that way here." And setting that up in that sort of fun sort of thing allowed for stuff like how can the, you know, late 40s, 50-ish, you know, Air Force guy who crashes here, how can his adult daughter eventually show up? You know, mm-hmm. who's like trained as a sorceress or whatever, or how can this, you know, or how can his old friend show up here, or how can he just be around as all these other characters, you know, when he meets up the characters in DC Universe and he can run at different times and stuff. And I always liked that about Skitaris, and I thought it was neat. And I liked the fact that they never explained, like, they explained it very vaguely as they look, time just works weird here, and then they move on.
Narnia.
Yeah, very Narnia. It was very, yeah, sort of like a really, really bad. It's like if Robert Howard wrote Narnia. that would be sort of how it works. It's like, because, yeah, it's definitely all about like scantily-clad women and beast men and giant monsters and, you know, something, that, a lot of stuff that would, you know, grace a Conan comic or story. And with a little bit of the John Carter, because, you know, guy from our world finds himself in this other world. I mean, it's technically at the center of the earth, but, you know, still. But no, it was really, Warlord was just a personal favorite of mine, really great. It was cool to be able to do all those characters, and it was nice to be able to squeeze in all those characters. So that was probably my meatiest entry.
Yeah, I think that was one of the entries that, you know, I didn't actually at the time know that you did it, but I was like, ooh, they got Warlord in this book. I was expecting him to be in the universe. And then I flipped the pages, and I'm like, oh, they got everybody.
That was me. I was just like, I am making this happen. Well, and also it was like, it's a problem when you have something you really love. Who do you take out? You know, mm-hmm. It's like, I'm like, oh, well, I got to put Jennifer Morgan in because she shows up in like, you know, other stuff more often. So she's got to be in there. And it's like, well, it seems weird to have Warlord without his wife, Tara, because she can fight and is cool, too. But then what about Machiste and Shakira? And it's, yeah. And then, of course, then it just keeps going. So, so I was able to squeeze those all in.
I also look at this now and I start realizing how many like famous singers have names.
Yeah.
It's like Mariah Carey and Shakira.
yeah. It's always funny. It's like, oh, that's really amusing. That's kind of amusing how they're popping up. Yeah, it was. Speaking of another entry, I don't know what, something reminded me of this, so I'll just throw that out there. Another one I worked with, I did the Secret Six entry. I don't think anybody's seen that. So I did Catman, and then in the first volume, I did Secret Six in the second. And that was fun. That one's interesting because I think John and Steve went back and added some of the more recent, like Dwarf Star and King Shark. I'm not sure if they added them or they transplanted them to. But the various Secret Six, you know, like Parademon and Scandal Savage and Jeanette and everything were all done by me. So Ragdoll and such, which was fun. Also interesting characters to try to model, like, you know, somebody who's got the spirit of, like, you know, immortal with the spirit of like a banshee possessing her, but she doesn't have the same powers as Silver Banshee, who I also did. You know, ditto for, you know, Ragdoll, like the super contortionist guy and some other stuff. It's like, it was fun. It was fun. I like those characters a lot. And that's actually one of the things I'm missing the most out of the new reboot is I miss my Catman Secret Six sort of team. I really liked the way direction they were going and what they were doing. And I was like, I'm sure they popped up in various ways, but that was one of the titles that not being relaunched and not keep going was sort of very, very, very sad for me just to see that go. but they're all in there, including Black Alice, who I also did because she's one of those, like, she was tough too. She was not.
Yeah, she had to have been one of the toughest characters to try and model that power because it's a very simple narratively power. It's being, you know, it's one of these things a writer can just do, and then a person sitting there trying to design a game around it goes, what the hell?
It's not the most difficult power I had to do for DC Adventures, but it is up there. The most difficult power is one of the characters I did for DC Universe. And I probably shouldn't say what that character is because it hasn't really been announced or whatever. But the one power that made me go, really? Really? Okay, yeah. That was indeed one of the characters in DC Universe.
I think I know who you're talking about, but I can't say anything.
And it is, and when DC Universe comes out, I'll mention it, and people will go, yeah, that must have been nightmarish. I said, yes, it was. So, but it was up there. Black Alice was up there. She was definitely up there. Let's see, what else, other entries they talk about interestingly. I did Ocean Master. There really isn't. I like Ocean Master, but there isn't a lot to say about him other than he's Ocean Master, and, you know, it worked pretty well. And I put the sidebar for the unpowered version of him, the tech version, the tech pirate version. But he's Ocean Master. He's, you know, Aquaman's evil brother who wants to destroy him. So, and he's got power. He's, you know, traded his soul for mystic powers, and that's basically it. I mentioned before I did Silver Banshee, who I always really liked as a character, like appearance-wise and such. I always thought she had a cool look and a cool concept. Her origin is a mess, let me say. And I actually eventually had to just kind of go back and settle up. But thankfully, right when I was writing her, there was an issue of Supergirl that came out where they reintroduced the character and they gave her origin. And so I said, this is the origin I am going with, because the other origins make no flippin' sense. Like, individually, each one of these origins makes sense, but they've all been used and never been retconned out. So, and then they came up with a version that basically used a lot of the old stuff, but altered and glassed over some other things, and I used that. And she was difficult because she was an example of, like, a character that had some funky linked abilities because, you know, she can hurt you anyway, but if she knows your name, she can kill you. And that was hard to, you know, but the same effect has to work at the same time. So, you know, if she screams at you and she doesn't know your name, she can still hurt you. And, or if she doesn't think you're who you think you are or whatever. And so it was having to make, like, a series of linked effects and only one of which only affects you if she knows your name. Which was, you know, a little tricky. It wasn't really tricky in the sense of it was impossible to figure out. It was just definitely it wasn't a conventional design. And also, I admit, she's also one of my comic reference characters. She has the one-armed grab and chokehold, so she can do burn locks. That was actually...
So she can do what?
Burn locks.
Oh, okay.
Because, which is the one-armed choke or grab back of neck maneuver that John Byrne used to love drawing in comics all the time. And she has done that in so many... He created her. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, in so many of her earlier appearances, she kept doing that because she's a John Byrne character and she's got super strength. And so that's how you show you have super strength in a John Byrne comic, particularly during that period, was by holding somebody up by their throat and either choking them with one hand or holding them by the back of their neck and, like, you know, holding them up to their allies and taunting them. And so when I was, you know, putting the character stats in, I was like, she's got to have one up. She's got to have improved grab and chokehold. She's got to have it. She's got to have the burn lock power, the burn lock combo, which is, by the way, if anybody wants to do a burn lock combo, that's how you do a burn lock combo. It's improved grab chokehold. There's your burn lock. So if you want to have you may occasionally see when I make a big epic villain guy with that combo so that they can have that, like, you know, holding the guy up by one hand by the throat and crushing the life out of them while monologuing. I don't remember if Kutu has it or not, but he might. Kutu
being a character that you put into
the threat reports.
The threat reports, which was characters in the Freedom City / Emerald City setting.
Yep.
Yeah.
But that was our podcast version of a footnote. But it was all accurate. That's all true. Let's see, the other entry I'll talk about briefly because it was just this is my other entry that I requested, and this is the worst kept secret about me is I love super animals. I love super animals. I'm not like so much in the sense of a furry in the sense that I love, like, lots and lots of anthropomorphic animals and stuff. I think they're neat, and I do like, you know, stuff like Princess Mononoke and stuff like that. But I love super animals, super pets. I love Lockjaw. I love Lockjaw and the Pet Avengers. I love Crypto. I particularly love Crypto. I can't explain it other than I like pets. I like animals. I like dogs and cats and such. And I like superheroes. So I guess it's natural that I would like those two things. And so I did the Super Animals entry, and I was very happy to do so. And so, and that was with Streaky, Crypto, and Rex the Wonder Dog. Well, Rex got in there because I desperately wanted to put Rex in. And I just, Rex has always been a favorite sort of obscure DC character of mine. And when John Lighthouser asked me, you know, Crypto and Streaky are definites, but who else should go in? I go, well, I'm going to lobby hard for Rex because, you know, he showed up in Shadow Pact. He was, you know, hung out with Superboy. And post-Crisis, most of these other super animals really haven't shown up much. And, you know, Ace the Bad Hound is awesome and all, but Ace the Bad Hound is like a really well-trained, you know, German Shepherd with a mask. And, I mean, that's what he is. You know, that you want, that is all he is. I mean, seriously, like, Ace is cool and all, but that's what Ace is. He is a well-trained German Shepherd with a mask. You take a police dog and you slap a Batman mask on him and you've got Ace the Bad Hound. And then Comet is, the super horse has issues because Comet's like the centaur who got turned into a horse and he's still in love with Supergirl. And then in the Peter David's version, he was like a horse looking alien who turned into like one of Supergirl's classmates and was in love with her. But it was, and I just decided that it was like, you know what, for sake of my own sanity and, you know, I don't know, not having to go down certain routes, I'm just going to not put Comet in there, which I realize is probably people. Where's Comet? Comet Super Horse. If I had had space, I would have totally put him in there.
Yeah. If you want to actually get the full impression of just how kind of weird Comet can be, look him up Wikipedia, and read that entry and say to yourself, how would you explain this to anybody who is either over 9?
Yes.
And, you know, over 9 years old. It's like, a kid totally gets it. This doesn't not even phase a child. Anyone who's read Axe Cop will understand that.
Yeah.
But adults have all this baggage that they'll bring to that storyline and just look at it and go, that's so wrong.
Yes. And that was sort of, and then it was like Beppo the Super Monkey. I mean, he's a super monkey, but it was the problem, again, of like, he hasn't shown up in a while. And for me, it was, you know, for me wanting to include Rex is, one, he's a favorite of mine. I think it's kind of a shame that the Robert Conagher's Rex Wonder Dog series hasn't been collected in some sort of omnibus or showcase yet. But the thing with Rex is, it's like, Rex is the quintessential Wonder Dog. Like, you know, as cool as Ace the Bad Hound or whatever these other sort of dog characters are, Ace can't ride a horse. You know, he can't, like, swing from a vine and, like, kick a jaguar off a tree limb or whatever, or, like, fight a, you know, or he's never fought, like, a reanimated Tyrannosaurus Rex, you know, or whatever. By the way, these are all things that Rex has actually done. I'm not making any of this up. These are in actual stories that he did. You know, Ace the Bad Hound never adventured through the microverse, you know, and before, by the way, the Atom even showed up. You know, Rex just seemed like the obvious, like, you know, other character to add because he was sort of the quintessential super pet. And also with he was also partners with Bobo Detective Chimp for a long time. And since Bobo was getting his entry in Shadow Pact, it seemed fair that Rex would get his. It also allowed me to create one of my favorite features ever, which was Wonder Dog. Which is basically a feature that just allows you to do things that a dog normally wouldn't be able to do without penalty. It's basically like, it's like improvised tools, except instead of you don't need tools, you don't need hands. You know, you're a dog, and if you can come up with even the craziest way in the world that the dog can do this thing, he can just attempt it without penalty. Which, if anybody looks at old Rex Wonder Dog comics, will go, no, that actually makes perfect sense. there's actually a relatively famous cover, at least as far as the character goes, of him riding on back of a horse up a steep ledge with an unconscious man draped over the saddle with the reins in his teeth and, like, guiding the horse up the ledge, like, to safety. There is a number of questions that must raise if you see this. How did he get up there? How did he get the guy up there? Why isn't the horse freaking out? You know, how did he know how to ride a horse up a steep ledge? That requires a certain level of equestrian skill. None of these are answered by anything other than he is Rex the Wonder Dog. So, hence the Wonder Dog feature. And then, of course, Crypto, who I love, and Streaky, who really hasn't shown up post-Crisis either, but Streaky was featured in Wednesday Comics and some other stuff. And Streaky is also, Streaky was in the cartoon, the Crypto cartoon, and some other stuff. And so I was like, he relatively high-profile character as far as super pets go. So, you know, and I could have done, you know, 12 more super pets. Yeah, I could have done the whole Legion of Super Pets and stuff. So, So that actually, the Legion of Super Pets also raises my crazy question of, because I could have thrown in Prody, who is Chameleon Boy's pet, though the problem with Prody is always the weird mix of you have a sentient shapeshifter whose pet is a sentient smaller shapeshifter, and what makes him a pet? The fact that he is smaller? I mean, seriously, that is the... Prody is smart enough to pose as full humans and talk and, you know, reason, and at one point he sacrifices himself and makes the decision that his life isn't important and somebody else's, he will go on to do greater things. You know, he does things that require high reasoning facilities, and he can shapeshift into anything. And he's a pet. And it was always like, again, kids aren't fazed by this. The kid just looks at it and goes, oh, he's a cute little shapeshifting pet. I wish I had a Prody. And adults, you know, it's this deep philosophical quandary where, you know, Chameleon Boy may be involved in, like, 30th century slavery. Yeah. So it's just, you know, it was just, it seemed like it was just, you know, I hit the highlights and moved on. But that said, if I had room, I would have totally done all those characters, because that would have been fun.
Yeah, yeah. I do like the fact that we had both, you know, Crypto and Rex. I mean, Streaky obviously is a fun character, but yeah. You know, just kind of showing the range of you know, what constituted a hero animal. Those
I also really like. I had a lot of fun with those characters. I had a lot of fun with the complications and the features and those things. I mean, it was really fun to make something that I wanted to make a viable PC option to. Like, if somebody really wanted to play this character, I would say, look, this is, you can do this. You can play this character. Mm-hmm. Not only could you have this as a sidekick or whatever, you could play this character. You know, if you got the, you know, Rex is probably the easiest because he can talk. But you could play, you know, the hyper-intelligent, you know, like, you know, animal character in a group if you really wanted to. And you could also play a group of them. I mean, you could do a Pet Avengers campaign, you know, and you could do a Legion of Super Pets event campaign. I think there's a line, I believe it is, I think it may have been from my Super Animals entry, but I may have cribbed it from somewhere else. I don't remember that opposable thumbs are not a measure of heroism. that's actually sort of the, you know, the sort of the idea is, like, you can be, you know, you can do that and have fun with it. So, but yeah, so I did that. I'm trying to think of other characters I did that might be interesting. But I did Orion. I really like Jack Kirby's New Gods, and it's actually something that I think has grown on me as I've gotten older. I used to think that Jack Kirby was okay, and then as I got older, I'm like, I appreciate him literally more every year as an artist and as a creator, and what he was trying to do and what he created and what he added to comics. And Orion was fun because he was the one character... There's a tendency when you design a lot of characters to not want to combat monster optimize a lot. You just don't want to. I mean, we have a tendency, I think, as gamers not do that all the time. We want to have somebody with a little more depth and a little more, you know, you don't want to necessarily, like, you know, it's okay to hit your power caps, but you don't want to be too crazy with it or whatever. It was kind of nice to have a character with Orion that was basically just an excuse to power optimize and combat optimize and make this combat monster, because that's what Orion is. You know, to be sitting there going, I am not worried about this seeming like I'm filling in points to hit caps just because. It's like, he's Orion. It's what he does. I mean, I think he's also a really good model for people that want to play that sort of character. You know, look, I just want to play a guy who's really good at fighting and really good at beating stuff up, and I just want to make sure that I got all my damage caps and everything hit, and I want to go in and have a good time, and this is my, you know, this is my fun, this is my weekend, you know, I got a stressful job or whatever, and this is what I do for fun, I beat up bad guys with my, you know, completely optimized, you know, brawling, blasting, badass character, and Orion is that guy, and so it was kind of fun to make him and have fun with that, and also, you know, just, you know, actually realize that I had to just shut down any inclinations of not wanting to optimize, you know, or not wanting to, you know, well, I better make sure I'm not doing it just for the sake of doing it. It's like, no, I'm doing it because you need to, because it's Orion. So it was kind of, I also did those. I'm trying to think what else I did. I'm sure there are other characters I'm doing and I'm just blanking on, and it's not because I didn't love them and adore them. It's just because I don't remember them right off the top of my head.
I will say this, and this is a little sidestep, and I apologize to John Lighthouser for stomping on the DC Adventures time with another, you know, minor plug for Vigilance Press stuff. But you know, when we were talking about doing the Elements of Ruin storyline, one of the background characters that Jack has decided to introduce is a hero animal. And yeah. And I basically, you know, I basically kind of, you know, trying to nail him down to get Jack to do an entire supervillain team of animals for me. So
I am willing to do that at some point.
Wants to see that, please comment
on this. If you want it, I can do it. I've got the ideas.
Let me know if there's a market. I would like to do an entire team of animal supervillains as a due vigilance, and then maybe have a whole article in there on animal superhero campaigns as well.
As would I. So I'm just saying.
One of my favorite old school comics, and this goes back to the 70s at some point. I don't remember exactly because I don't have it anymore, but it was one of these old Silver Age kind of Superman storylines where it was a backup story in a Superman book. And mm-hmm. the whole thing, I believe it was Mr. Mixoplick trying to mess with Crypto, mm-hmm. and he kept running up against Crypto's animal nature, and Crypto's basically running around trying to deal with all these crazy things that Mixoplick was doing. But Mixoplick was trying not to be seen, so it was like everybody thought that Crypto was being a bad dog. Mm-hmm. Because he was running around and doing, you know, Mixoplick would like possess a water hydrant or something, right. and you know, the dog would attack it, and people thought, mm-hmm. you know, he's just being a bad dog, and he was really trying to stop Mixoplick. It was just one of those things where that complication of not being able to talk to people really got in his way.
One of my favorite bits recently, which I thought was just seriously like almost kind of misty eyed from a comic, was I think it was in smack dab in the middle of like the, you know, pretty good, but otherwise, you know, fairly average Superman story where Atlas comes back and he fights Atlas. And towards the end of the fight, Superman's just getting the crap kicked out of him because they're using some sort of weird, like super weapon to help out his opponent, and that's blasting him with like some sort of magical blast or something that's basically robbing him of his powers. And for some reason, it doesn't quite work on Crypto the same way. So Crypto basically, you know, fights off Atlas and, you know, gets him down and, you know, saves Superman and saves everybody. And, you know, at the end of it, you know, everybody's cheering Superman, and he stops and he says, no, he goes nuts. That's not, you know, I'm not the hero here. You know, I'm not the one going, yeah, I mean, I always try to fight, but he's the one. He points at Crypto and he goes, he's the one who saved you. And he's not just my dog. He's your dog too. You know, and I didn't always see that either, because there was like a long time he had Crypto locked up in the Fortress of Solitude because he was worried about him. He's a dog. What if he goes crazy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And he's like, you know, I was wrong. And, you know, people who were worried about him were wrong. And he's your dog. You know, he's my dog and he's your dog. And they all cheer Crypto. And he's all like, you know, wagging his tail and being happy. And I'm just like, oh, it's really a sweet sort of fun, like heroic story. There's also another one done a few years ago that where Crypto fought Mongol, and the whole thing's told from Crypto's perspective as a very, very smart dog, but still a dog. Mm-hmm. And it's also written in the sort of storybook sort of, you know, where it's very much written in an issue where this is like, I mean, you could pull this comic book out and read it to a kid. You know, you could, and it would read it to like a 2-year-old, and they would like, there's no words or anything that would get them, because it was just a, you know, it starts out like Crypto is a white dog with a red cape. You know, he is, you know, he's Superman's dog, you know, Superman, and he and Superman, you know, and it basically, it's very simple and intentionally so. And it creates this really interesting tale of like the dog from Crypto's perspective, and how, you know, Crypto also has the element at the end where he's like, you know, like Mongol tries to gets like pulls Kryptonite or something crazy and is about ready to grab Superman, or maybe he's ready to grab Lois or something, and Crypto just jumps on him and nearly rips his throat out, which of course makes Superman worry a little bit. But at the same time, it's like, hey, you don't mess with, like, you know, if anybody's had a dog, you know, it's just like, you don't sit there gloating and talk about how you're going to beat the dog's master to death. This is not going to end well for you. And especially if the dog has heat vision. So that's really that's what I was really liked about that character. I love in Young Justice now that Superboy's got his own little weird version of Crypto with that giant genetically engineered wolf that he's got, a genetically engineered white wolf follow him around. I kind of wish he'd just call it Crypto, but I think it's kind of awesome anyway. It's just like, yeah, every Superboy needs a dog. And for a while there, Superboy had Crypto too, which is cool. Mm-hmm. And that was interesting too, because he kind of got stuck with him, and he was like, you know, I don't want this dog. And I was like, yeah, Superboy is being Superboy. And then I think it was probably 2 issues in, and he's like, okay, having a dog that's got superpowers is kind of cool. So, but yeah, so I mean, that's most of the characters I did. I'm sure there's a couple I'm just blanking on along the way. that I just kind of feel bad about. And again, it's not that I didn't, because I feel bad too, because I know that I really liked every single character I worked on. There wasn't, but also I had a few more larger entries this time, so I didn't quite have as many like smaller ones as I did last time. But it was cool because I, you know, like the Question constituted, you know, two characters and a side character. And Warlord constituted like one main character and a bunch of supporting characters. And the Secret Six had its own entry and it was big. And so, you know, Super Animals had, you know, three animals plus, you know, a discussion of it. So I think I actually wrote more for Heroes and Villains Volume 2 than I did Volume 1. But it just was in slightly larger chunks. But no, that's Heroes and Villains. That's Heroes and Villains Volume 2. That's what I worked on. I also did some work on Emerald City. It's coming up at some point. I'm not sure when, but it is.
I think, and this goes back to last year, but I believe that John was stressing they were trying to get it out by Gen Con, but I don't know what the actual timetable on that is right now.
I also did, for folks who enjoyed my threat reports for Meet Some Masterminds, the two that came out, Jade Spider and Cthulhu the Eternal, there will be the compilation of that, and there will be more for me. So there were some other ones of mine that got put in there. So
I'm definitely looking forward to the compilation.
Yeah, I'm pretty happy with them. I'm glad there's a couple in there that I really wanted to put in, and they just got added later and added to it. John wanted to put some extra content in for folks buying the print version, which I think is awesome. And I've seen the art for it, and it's just wow. Anthony Castrillo, I believe, did all the art for it. If he didn't, I could be wrong. I apologize to any other another artist who might be listening to it, but. He's a guy that did my Jade Spider Kutu illustrations as well, I believe. And he's just wow. It was just I saw the stuff he did, and I was like, wow, this is just gorgeous. So yeah, so pretty cool. But yeah, I have a few characters extra for me in there, and some other stuff coming up, both for some of y'all. So I got some Green Ronin stuff coming up. I got some Marvel Margaret Weiss stuff coming up. Got stuff coming up from Grit Vigilance Press, stuff we talked about. It's probably some other stuff we were probably not ready to talk about yet. I'm also working on a and this is in the very early stages of development, so I'm going to get too excited. I mean, not that it won't come out, but this, you know, it's not going to be tomorrow. I'm working on a space opera game using with a couple people I know. Using the Barbarians of Lemuria basic system that Simon Washburn developed, and also seen in variations in Barbarians of the Aftermath, Dogs of War, and Chris Kutowski over at Bash's Honor and Intrigue. And we're going to do my own. We're going to do like a space opera sort of, you know, Babylon 5, Star Wars, Mass Effect-y sort of style version of that rule set with its own setting and such. And that will most likely be getting Kickstartered and such. But like I said, I'll keep people posted as that gets closer. But I just, you know, that is in development. That is yet another thing, because apparently I don't have enough work to do. So,
well, it's kind of like, you know, a lot of people talk about gamer ADD, how like, or campaign ADD, where they can't settle on a single campaign. Mm. And I think the way that people like you and I deal with that is this: we write the ideas, but
we eventually just have to say no. There's not too many more ideas I can do. But then at the same time, some things will happen. Like, you know, James and I talked about the Betaman idea, and then like I just wrote it kind of in between other things. You know, it was just like, okay, let's just do this thing. It's a good idea. Let's do it. And one of the other projects we were talking about coming up that we probably shouldn't talk about yet because it's in really preliminary stages was literally me just sort of saying, I have this idea that I kind of would like to do something with at some point. And James is like, I love this idea and we should do something with it at some point. And that was, you know.
If it's the idea I'm thinking of, I still want to do that like right now.
Yeah, I can't write it fast enough. That's the thing. Like, I can't write it fast enough, nor can anyone illustrate it fast enough. So I just have to keep the energy up and keep working at it.
Yeah.
So when I got time to get it going, but yeah, it's definitely it's definitely one of those things where, you know, and that's also, you know, we talk about like things like release schedules and things that sometimes happens too. In addition to the real world, you know, printing delays or art takes a while, or, you know, you just need to give, you know, somebody else a chance in the queue to get some stuff out or whatever. Sometimes things will just hit you that are just so great and the energy is there. You'll just go for it, you know, and that's another factor too. So, you know, and I think that's something that like a lot of times with game companies in general, it's not always, but a lot of times, like sometimes if, you know, rarely if something isn't coming out is something not coming out because people are sitting around doing nothing.
Right.
It's not coming out because there's been a realistic real world delay. Something else had to take priority or, you know, something else just, you know, seemed like it was a better idea to work on at the time because it was more topical to what was going on or whatever. And, you know, I'm not saying people never burn out and take breaks and don't do stuff for a while, or that, you know, things don't shut down sometimes. It happens. But in most cases, I know it's like, you know, people are usually like, you know, those are usually a couple days, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not really like, you know, this long meandering thing of like, it's like, no, it's usually a couple days. It's usually a couple days and then you get back to it, you know. And one thing actually, the sort of with the sort of writer, designer, ADD sort of issue that I find is useful is that if I burn out on working on something for Meet Some Masterminds, I can turn over around and work on Marvel. And if I get burned out on Marvel, that I can turn around and work on. I mean, the problem is I have not yet been burned out in recent years in everything that I'm doing in that regard. So I have my own sort of side creative stuff has not been getting as much work as it should because I keep jumping from project to project. And, you know, I have yet to find that period of a week where I'm not ready to do anything on anything else and I can move on and do like work on like a short story or a novel that I've been, you know, plunking away at. But hopefully soon. But I figured, you know, I've got these ideas and people are interested and cool people to work with and, you know, might as well push forward on those as much as possible. So, but yeah, so, you know, that's, I got a bunch of stuff coming out, I guess. And, you know, it's a bunch of stuff coming out for Vigilance Press, both for me and other folks, and a bunch of stuff coming out Margaret Weiss. In addition to all the Marvel stuff, I know at some point they've got that Dragon Brigade game coming out. I know it's been pushed down the queue. Again, we talked about, you know, people are excited about Marvel. Marvel needs a big push. That's going to be done, but, you know, I know that project isn't dead. I just know it's been kind of, you know, slowed down a bit. And ditto for, you know, I'm Green Ronin, I know, has got, you know, they've got a lot of stuff coming out, and it's just a matter of getting it all out. You know, they got Heroes and Villains out, but, you know, they've got a bunch of other things they want to do. And plus doing the weekly power profiles, which are awesome. Just got the latest preview of one of the new ones to review, and it's pretty cool. So,
yeah. Yeah, that was one of the things, I haven't been participating the last couple of weeks, but as much as I'd like, but I really, getting to see those put together and having some input on that was yeah. one of the great privileges that I was able to participate in this year, and I really, yeah. I understand that there is some criticism on the microtransaction approach to publishing stuff like this, and I totally understand, you know, people who don't want to buy things in little bits and pieces. Mm-hmm. With the understanding, I, as far as I understand it, they have every intention of doing a collected edition. And what the, you know, you can kind of look at yep. this is like, you know, almost like a crowdsourced version of Ultimate Power, just kind of. They're pulling it into smaller pieces so that we can look over these things with a microscope and they can take the feedback from each week and put it into mm-hmm. the next week. And it really kind of, I think it's going to lead to a much more robust final compilation mm-hmm. than, you know, as awesome and it was awesome, when it came out, the second edition book, Ultimate Power for Mutants and Masterminds, second edition, was a fantastic book, indispensable in my campaign. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I could not run. Once that came out, I refused to run a game without it. But it was. I think what we're getting out of the current crop of power profiles, mm-hmm. By and large, I've just been some fantastic ideas, getting to see some new modifiers that really enhance the game without breaking the game balance.
Right.
And really seeing that attention to things without overstepping. You know, like, you know, even in Ultimate Power, there were a couple of things in there that just didn't feel balanced right. Mm-hmm. But this really feels like everything's getting the attention it deserves, and it's really getting, you know, a sharp focus on development. And I'm really excited to see, you know, what they come out with each week. And
yeah,
it's a lot of fun to be part of that process. And
there's definitely some really great stuff that, you know, I think that's, you know, I've been sort of falling recently into working a lot on superhero stuff, which is probably one of the reasons why a couple of my new projects are a little, as much as I love superheroes, are probably a little more, you know, outside of superhero realm a little bit. But it's just so neat to see right now there are two companies out there for sure. I mean, two big ones, you know, working on the Marvel and DC license, and then, of course, a lot of smaller companies like Vigilance Press and such, just trying to do a really great job and learn how to kind of like, you know, do new stuff and do new stuff for the fans and such. And it's really cool. I mean, you know, we've got the microtransaction sort of model and the threat reports and stuff from each masterminds in addition to the books they're working on. And, you know, Marvel's kind of going more for this event structure or whatever. But I just think it's cool to have these options and the stuff out there. And also it's nice when, you know, from the inside I can say that, you know, as much as a fan might read something and just, you know, like, this is wrong. It's like, we all love this stuff. You know, we all love this stuff. You know, it's we're not sitting there, you know, thinking I'm going to do this power or this ability or this thing wrong, so you're going to tear your hair out. It's not that, you know, it's not that at all. It's just, you know, sometimes people have different opinions on things looking forward to stuff coming out, though. Looking stuff that's already out. I mean, it's just... but yeah, so I'm kind of meandering here at the end because I don't know what else to say, really. It's kind of like the Avengers looks cool. I don't know what else to say.
Man, that's just, you know, I've heard there's this other Marvel movie coming out this year that also looks pretty tight, the Spider-Man movie.
Yeah, Spider-Man looks pretty cool. I'm actually... then, of course, you know, it's funny because that stuff is so fairly close. I'm not... You know, there's stuff that I'm not even like... I'm not even excited about it yet because my brain has not fully processed that it's coming out like The Hobbit.
There's
going to be a time sometime after the big glut of cool, awesome summer movies that I'm just going to turn into like a 4-year-old and just be like, Hobbit, you'll get to see Gimli or whatever, again or whatever, and just be super Gandalf and be super excited. I just recently saw Cabin in the Woods, which was awesome. I know James saw it, too. That was cool. Highly recommend. And, yeah, other than that, it's like, but yeah. But, so, yeah, it's just like my multimedia exposure, though. I watch, you know.
When you bring up The Hobbit, I do have to say that when they released the trailer back at Christmas, and people who know me know my love for Tolkien. I read those books annually. And just seeing and hearing them sing in the trailer, just the hair on the back of my neck stood up. I mean, there's a certain level of fanboy love and excitement and a rush I get from going to see movies like The Avengers. I'm really looking forward to that. But The Lord of the Rings was like, there is so much of who I am wrapped up in the discovery of Tolkien's work when I was so young and when, you know, when my dad used to read the books to me and everything. When I saw the trailer and I saw, you know, I'd been seeing the videos, the behind the scenes videos and the pictures of the characters in costume, all kind of piecemeal. But when you get to see everything in the context of the story and the context of the setting, oh, it was magic. And I just cannot wait for that. But just looking at all the amazing, wonderful things coming out in cinemas this year, I'm really excited about being a movie fan. It's a lot of
fun. Yeah, a lot of really, really cool stuff going on. One last shout out. Speaking of the Avengers, I'm going to give a shout out because this is something I have nothing at all to do with it, but I'm going to throw it out there because it's going to be it's been really cool. A lot of my friends who are not huge comic fans but like the Avengers and like comics have been getting a lot of use out of is they collected the interviews with the Avengers from the back of Avengers comics from a couple years ago that Brian Michael Bendis wrote in the various Avengers titles, where they're talking about it. I think it's called like Avengers Assemble, like an oral history of the Avengers or something. And it's a little comic digest sized thing. And it includes basically interviews with the various characters as the characters talking about, you know, when we could put the Avengers together and when we fought the Kree-Skrull War and all this stuff. And multiple people I know have actually just commented on how fun it is to read these things. And it's like, yeah, I never read those comics as a kid or whatever, you know, and I never really like, I didn't know, I knew that story existed, but I didn't know, you know, I didn't really get the feel of it before. And I'm kind of hoping Marvel takes a page and does these for X-Men and some other stuff.
Yeah. It's about $10. It's on Amazon and it's called Avengers Assemble. Yes. No D, you know, or anything. It's Assemble, but with no exclamation point either. It's just Avengers Assemble, : an oral history of Earth's mightiest heroes.
And it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun, and it's one of those things that I have handed to many a person who is not, who's like, I like the Avengers, I want to know more about it. It's like, well, why don't we start here? You know, why don't we start here? Why don't you get your basic, you know, here's a basic, fun, entertaining read that will give you the gist of the Avengers, you know, up to a certain point. And I'm kind of hoping, like I said, I'd like to see Marvel. So if anybody from Marvel happens to be listening to this on the rare chance I'm not holding my breath, other than please hire me to write comics, I will also say please do more of those. because, yeah, those are they're pretty awesome. They're pretty awesome. Anyway, so well, we should probably wrap up. We've been going on for a while.
So thank you very much for tuning in, guys, ladies and gentlemen. And again, right now the plan is I should hopefully have Jason Tondreau stopping by. Cool. I'm looking at later this week. We're going to talk about some of the projects that he and I are working on, including the Fatal Five. The Forgotten Five. I'm getting my stuff conflated with what we were talking about with DC. But the Forgotten Five, which hopefully I'm going to see if I can't get Jesse Justice to stop by the show. He's been doing the artwork for that series, and it just looks tremendous. He's managed to capture that Kirby flavor in a way that so few people can. He took some of the characters that I probably would have zigged and he zagged, but he did it in such a fantastic way that I can't argue with the results. They're just like, yeah, that's the way it should have been done, and cool. That's fantastic stuff. So I'm actually trying to there's every chance that I may be using him for the Beta Men as well. So
cool.
Because he's got that kind of 50s style.
I could see that. Because the crazy way that I write aliens and stuff.
But yeah, one thing I will quote Jason Tondreau on when talking about Jesse Justice's artwork is when he turned in a picture for a character called Calendar Girl. Jason's response was, "Okay, I want Jesse to draw all of my female characters from now on."
I kind of feel that way a little bit about depending on the not for every single character, but for certain styles of character for Denise. I feel that way. Mm-hmm. Particularly there was a character that shows up as an also ran sort of additional character in Black Chapter that Denise did the drawing for, and I'm like, okay, from now on, I want her to draw like my sort of pulpy, sort of crazy, because I just love that.
Yeah,
but Dan still gets to draw all my giant commando Yeti monks because those things are awesome. But yeah, so I guess we're ready for the wrap up.
We are ready for the wrap up. All right, guys, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for tuning in. We're clocking in at about 2 hours, so again, apology for the long stretch, but you guys can go take your bathroom breaks now. And until next time, stay vigilant.
Stay vigilant.